All right. Good morning, everybody. We're going to start up now. I'm going to give a few introductory comments about the lecture, the topic, and how it relates to the class and the exam, and then we'll kind of get into it. So there are, as I said in the first day of class, there are two documents that are going to be principally the documents you guys will see throughout your career. They're AIA, American Institute of Architects. This is what the AIA stands for. These are form documents that have been around since the early 1900s. They're updated over the last 50 years, updated every 10 years. The B101, which is what we're going to talk about today, is the owner-architect agreement. And then in the second half of the semester, it's called the A201. That's the owner-contractor agreement. There's some other documents that go with the A201. We'll explain that a little bit more later. But the AIA, as I said, over 100 years ago, started creating these standardized forms. I would say that these documents, these two documents you go through, are somewhere between, if not the exact document, language almost exactly the same as this document, is in probably 70 to 80% of all the contracts you're going to see in the U.S. I work for, one of my clients is Microsoft. I do all their data centers in the Western Hemisphere. And their formed agreement, Microsoft has its own form agreement, but much of the language was derived from the A201 general conditions. I have negotiated thousands of contracts in my career. Many of them are these AIA documents. I was working on one last night. I probably have at any given time a half a dozen of these form documents between my various clients on my desk working through it. But if I sometimes will get a document from a contractor or from an owner or from an architect, it may not be in this form. It may not look like the form. It may not say AIA on it. But when you start reading the provisions in the document, the language tracks to it. So everything that I'm going to talk about, you guys will hear over and over and over again throughout your career. The second thing about the AIA documents is, which I said in my email last night, is if and when you decide to sit for your AREs and become a registered architect, this is the document you're going to be tested on. If they're going to ask you questions with respect to the AIA form. It may not say in the B101, but the questions are going to be based on this because it is the most generalized, standardized form in the country. There are other standard forms. There's documents that are, this of course, because AIA is created initially by architects. And so, as you would imagine, it has an architect slant to it. There are a series of form documents that are created for contractors. There are a series of form documents that are created for engineers. There are a series of form documents that are created for design builders. And they all cover the same thing. They have an owner-architect, they have an owner-contractor, so they all have the same suite or collection of documents. But this still is the predominant one used in the industry. The other thing about the AIA, like I said, the documents are the main documents are updated every 10 years. If you go onto the AIA website, you can go look at all the different types. And there's a series, we're going to have a lecture on this a little bit later, but the A series are always owner-contractor side. They deal with the construction side. Anytime you see a B series, it's going to deal with the owner and the architect. It's going to be an architect side. So why A wouldn't be architect, I don't know, but A is contractor, B is architect. The C series, there's a C series. The C series is going to be, if you have subcontractors, which would be on the construction side and the contractor side, or on the design side, the architect are for consultants. So the C series are for the next level down. And then there's G documents that deal with pay applications or everything else. But and in each series, like if you go to the A series, there's the A100s and the A200s, and there's probably 30 documents that you can choose from. And then the B series, there's 7 documents you can choose from. What we're going to cover today is the B101. And again, we'll go through a little bit more detail in a later slide, or later lecture. But the B101 is of the, when you have an owner-architect agreement, you can pick from 7 or 8 under the AIA forms. But the B101 is used the most often. So I would say 90% of your owner-architect agreements, if you're using the AIA forms, will be this one. So again, it's the most predominant. Last thing on the exam, for purposes of the exam, it's going to be somewhere between 30 to 40% of the questions will be based on this document. So it's an important lecture. I will get through, there's 13 provisions in this. I'll get through, we may get through all the first five. We always get through the first four. It just kind of depends on how questions and answers go and everything else. And it's like, well, if you only get through four and you got 13, we get through the eight. The second half goes much faster. There's a lot more detail and content in the first four and five provisions. I go pretty rapid fire in this. And as you'll see in the slides, if you, I don't know if anybody had a chance to flip through them when I sent them out. There will be certain language in each paragraph, because I literally go through almost every single paragraph in the document, because you're going to need to know all this stuff. But in each paragraph, there'll be a sentence or two or three that's in bold and italicized. That's going to be the content I'll be talking about, because there may be some other, you know, you may have a paragraph that's 20 or 30 sentences long, but there may only really be, for purpose of what you guys need to know, three sentences in that provision that we want to talk about. So I'll point those out. That's what it comes up on the screen, what's important and what's not. So, all right? So, the document is put together by articles. So there's Article 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, like I said, through 13. The first one is an article. It's called Initial Information. If you think about the sequencing of when you are going to be in a construction project, the first thing is the owner says, oh, we want to build a building. What do we do first? Well, we need to hire an architect. Somebody has to design it. So construction has, what you need to think about is construction is a linear process. Now, how linear that process can be, how dragged out, there's different concepts of design build and overlapping and fast tracking, and we'll come up with those, we'll talk about those next week more importantly. But the first part of the first of the linear process is getting an architect. And the first thing you need to do is establish what's the initial information, what's the project about, who are the parties, where is it going to be located, and everything else. So Article 1 is the initial information. It's kind of like your background facts, but you need that into the document to establish what the agreement is. So you're going to talk about the owner, you're going to talk about what the physical characteristics, and then 1.1.3, first one that I think is important here that you guys got to remember, and I'm going to talk about concepts in contracts too. If you can see what I have highlighted here, it says cost of the work. Two things I want to point out, and you'll see this throughout all contracts. In drafting contracts, what you want to think of what is important is to have certain defined terms. If a term is defined, it's always going to be capitalized. A common word would be capitalized. So if you look here, cost of the work, the C and the W is capitalized. There's no reason to capitalize a cost or the work. There's no reason to capitalize that other than it's a defined term. And in fact, this says the cost of the work as defined in 6.1. So next week we're going to talk about 6.1. We'll get there eventually. But I wanted to point that out. But cost of the work is how you draft contracts. If you think about up here, if you go to 1.1.1, owner is capitalized. Project is capitalized. Those become defined terms. So as you're reading through a contract, sometimes it's a lot shorter. There's a term that comes up. It's called the article or the. I'm blanking on here. Instruments of services. So instruments of services are what you guys create: drawings, specifications, axonometrics, 3D modeling, renderings, sketches, anything that has to do with what you guys create. It's actually called an instrument of service. And so it becomes this defined term. So when you are talking about that, you don't have to say, and the architect creates drawings, specifications, axonometrics, details, sketches, blah, blah, blah. You don't have to have this long laundry list. You just say, as defined instruments of service, they define it once. And then every time you see the word instruments of service, you know it includes all that laundry list. So that's why we use this in the concept of how you draft a contract. The other thing I'll talk about real quickly here, even though we're eventually going to get to a more detailed explanation of the cost of the work in paragraph 6.1, is the cost of the work for purposes of your thought process as an architect is the cost to construct the project. If you think about it, an owner comes in and they're like, I'm going to build this school. The first thing they need to do is they need to buy the land. That's the price of building the school. And the second thing I'm going to do, I'm going to hire an architect. That's the price of building the school. And the third thing I'm going to do is I'm going to hire a contractor. Not till we get to the point of hiring a contractor. The land, the architect's fees, the attorney's fees, the permitting, that stuff doesn't factor into the cost of the work. The defined term cost of the work, like I said, when we get more detailed, I'll show you everything that's included in it, but it's the cost to build the project. And it's, why is it in here, though? We're talking about an owner-architect agreement. Why do we care about the cost of the work in the owner-architect agreement? Well, a lot of times, your fee, how much you're charging, will be based on the cost of the work. I'm going to charge you a fee of 8% of the cost of the work. So that's why it's important. And the other thing, oh, the last thing, actually, I want to back up when I was talking about the AA suite of documents. All the defined terms in this document, the B101, will have the same definition in the A201 or in a C document or in another different series. That's why you want to work with this suite of documents. If you're going to have an AIA owner-architect agreement in the beginning, don't then get a random owner-contractor agreement. I've been in cases like that where I have one form and a different form and the definitions don't match. And then you got to figure out which is right. So this suite of documents, of all the AIA form documents, they all have the same definitions from contract to contract to contract. It's for consistency. And if you remember, when we talked about what are the important things about contracts and the law and torts, it's predictability. It's so the parties can understand what the deal is. And so when we have consistent terms and predictability, we can have a good deal. We know what's going on. Okay. Next, there's some talking about the design under 1.1.4. It talks about dates and completion, timing, how long it's going to do the project completed. Procurement and delivery method, it may be where we're going to do fast track, how much we're going to pay the contractor, some things like that. 1.1.6, though, is what I want to highlight in this screen. It talks about the owner's anticipated sustainable objective for the project. So we can see already here we have three separate defined terms. Owner, we already know, is defined. Sustainable objective, and we'll talk about what that means in a second. And the project. Those are three defined terms in that. The sustainable objective here is going to be in 1.1 and 6.1. So it's going to talk about, and we're going to use, if you want to have sustainability, you're going to use another form document called the E204. And the E204 is going to talk about how the parties want to deal with sustainability. Now, I highlight these provisions briefly because as the AIA forms morph and build and grow from every 10 years, there are things that come up in society that they recognize. So it's not just about how lawsuits happen or how to protect an architect. If you go back to this is the 2017, if you go back to the 2007 version, they talk a little bit about green, I mean, that's what sustainability is, but it doesn't have this E204, it doesn't have this form document. If you go back to the 97, so you go back two versions, and it just says, oh, the architect may consider sustainability. So what's happened as the contracts have morphed and as the AIAs recognize what's going on in society is they've now built in a provision that says, hey, if we're going to have a sustainable project, here are forms that are going to help you out so we're all on the same page. Now, it's not required to have sustainable. If you look at the first part, it says, if the owner identifies a sustainable objective, and I will say this, sustainability, when you do green buildings, and I'm sure you guys have probably heard of LEED, or Green Globes, or even the city of Chicago has its own green building code. Sustainability in the projects I've worked on, I would say definitely less than 10%, maybe less than 5% of my projects, do the owners want to pay for a sustainable project. And it's not necessarily that the building materials and the thought process that the architects go through is more expensive. It's the documentation that's required. If you're going to do a LEED building, the documentation you have to do to go ahead and get certified for LEED is in the tens of thousands of dollars, and a lot of owners don't want to pay for that. So what they say to the architect is, design me a green building, but I'm not going to go through all the requirements to have the sustainable objective and to file for LEED. I just know that you're doing your best to give me a green building. So, one point, any questions on that, on sustainability? Good. Okay, 1.1.7. The owner identifies the following representative in accordance with Section 5.3. So 5.3 talks about owner's obligations. Each section talks about different parties. Article 5 talks about the owner's responsibilities. So in 5.3, it says, hey, we got to find out who your owner's rep is. When you're on a construction project, it's really important to have single point communication. You don't want to have the contractor have six or seven people on the project site and they all have the authority to make a decision. You want one person or two would be a project manager and a superintendent. Same on the owner side. So what here is the owner identifies the following representative, and in 117 you would then put down the name, approve the party. If the contractor has questions or if the architect has questions, who are they going to talk to? Is it the homeowner if you're building a home? If you're going to build a hospital, is it going to be a super, you know, like a manager of the hospital? Is it going to be somebody that's specifically appointed to it? When I was my first year as a lawyer, I went to work for a law firm, and they were in a building, the Equitable Building, which is right on Michigan Avenue, right at the river. It's right across the street from the Tribune Tower. That building was an asbestos-laden building. And so they had to remove all the asbestos. And so the building itself was doing asbestos abatement. And my firm that I went to go work for, I'd been working there for probably 2 or 3 weeks. And the building had been doing floors, shuffling the floors. And they came to our office and they said to the managing partner, they said, we are going to move you to floor 17 in the process of being abated so we can abate your floor. So we got relocated. And we will pay for your new design for your space. And they knew I was an architect, or had an architectural degree, the firm that I worked for. So they asked me to be on the design team. So I have actually designed the office space for them, worked with some architects, and used some of my designs for it. I became the owner's rep. I was the one to talk to the architect all the time. We didn't put my name in the contract because I wasn't a partner, so they didn't want to legally do that. But I was basically the owner's rep. And that can happen with any of you guys. Sometimes, or any owner, they'll tell you who it is that you want to communicate with. So 1.1.9, the owner shall retain the following consultants and contractors. It tells you, in addition to the architect, because the architect's going to do design, but the architect may not do all the types of design. So this talks about you may have to hire, the owner will hire a geotech engineer, a civil engineer, maybe some other ones, landscape and everything else. So the architect comes, and they are going to file and provide, again, in 1.1.10, the architect's going to have their name of the representative, who's the project manager for the architect. And then in 1.1.11.1, they're going to say, this is what we're providing under the basic services. So the owner, geotech, civil, and other type engineers, but the architect is going to provide structural, mechanical, and electrical. That's traditional in all construction projects. Not all. In many, many construction projects, when you hire an architect, traditional architectural services, obviously the design is the architecture, that's predominant. But included in that will be structural, make sure the building doesn't fall down, mechanical, the HVAC system, everything else, and plumbing, and then electrical. Those are what's called, as we see, basic services, a defined term, capital B, capital S. So anytime you see throughout this document the term basic services, capital B, capital S, it will include any services provided by the structural, mechanical, electrical engineer. So you don't have to repeat those over and over. But those are your traditional basic services the architect is going to provide. Design, the architectural, aesthetic, and everything else is that's inherent for structural, mechanical, electrical. Okay? And all of these, you would put down underneath the structural, you put their name. You would put the name of the structural engineer if it's not somebody in-house. A lot of times the architect, these engineers will be subcontractors or sub-consultants that they retain. If it's in-house, maybe you go to a big firm and they have their own structural and mechanical, electrical departments, and they not have anybody else that may be internal. A lot of times they're external. So after each one of these paragraphs, you would see if you looked at the actual form, it's got a space, it's got a blank where you put their names in. Consultants retained under supplemental services. Again, a capitalized term. We'll talk about supplemental services in Article 4 today. But if there are more services provided in addition to structural, mechanical, or electrical, those would be supplemental. You would identify those. So let's say that somebody's going to be doing low voltage. Let's say somebody's going to be doing, like if you're doing a house, and maybe you have a security system, you're going to have a security system design. Or maybe you're going to do the AV system. A lot of, like if it's a high-end house, you have somebody that's going to do the AV for your whole house. Those would fall under supplemental, and those would go in because they're not basic structural, mechanical, electrical. Okay? Going down to 1.2, the owner and the architect, both parties to this agreement, may rely on the initial information. And then it says in highlighted here, initial information may materially change. So remember, this is the first part of this linear process. So we all think we know it's going to be a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house. We think it's going to be, 2,000 square feet. We think that it's going to be in a price range of $500,000. That's what you're going to put in for the initial information, its location, and so forth and so on. And it may turn out that you win the lotto, and all of a sudden you want to make it a four-bedroom, five-bath house, and you want to have it be, instead of a $500,000 house, it's a $2 million house. That initial information can materially change, materially being important. Like, it can be completely different. But in that event, the owner and the architect shall appropriately adjust the architect's services, schedule for the services, and compensation. So if I, the concept here is really simple. And what I want to try to say as we look through contracts, not just this contract, but every contract, the best way to draft a contract is to try to draft it in plain English and try to understand what it means simply. What this basically says is if you have a plan and the architect says, we can do this for $10,000, or let's be realistic here, we can design your house for $50,000 and it's going to take us 3 months, and you come back to us and the house doubles in size, you shouldn't be forced to have a house that's for $50,000 and do it in 3 months. It's going to take 7 months. It's going to be $150,000, whatever may happen from those changes. And that's what this acknowledges. Look, you changed it, we get to change our schedule and our time and our price. And that makes a lot of sense. So it's here, it's in the agreement. And then what you also want to think about, as I said, because these documents are updated every 10 years, you're going to find provisions in agreement in this agreement that you're like, well, Mike, of course it makes sense. If I was going to design a three-bedroom, two-bath house and it becomes a four-bedroom, five-bath house, why wouldn't the architect get paid more? Doesn't that make a lot of sense? Of course it makes sense. But because there probably were lawsuits about what's material or not, about whether the architect told them they should have gotten paid more and everything else, the AAA, sometime in the last 50 years, stuck the sentence in to say, guys, we don't want to have this question, or what really makes a lot of sense, let's just put the sentence in so everybody knows what the deal is. And that's what this term says. If we change things, you get paid more money for it, you get more time than otherwise. Okay? Yes?
So, when the
great question. So the question was, if the initial information changes, do you have to sign a new contract? Do you have to opt out? The answer is no. What you want to do, and it's much more common in the construction world, it's called what's called, you enter into what's called a change order. And a change order is a document that says, we have this agreement, the four corners of the agreement, that says X. But I want to do X plus Y, or I want to do X minus Z. Like your question was, what if they add, or what if they subtract? If you add, so the change order says the parties have agreed that they're adding Y. And as a result of adding Y, the original contract is going to have more money, more time, or whatever the details is of adding Y. And you want to put that information in, and that is a change order to the original contract. So you don't have to renegotiate everything from the very beginning, as long as you're not saying, you know, I hired you to build me a school, but now I really want you to do is I want you to hire, I'm going to build a factory in the same spot. That would be then a new contract because it's such a cardinal change. It's such a radical difference. But if you're just adding things or subtracting, and if it says if it's instead of adding Y, it's subtracting Z, the change order says the same thing. The price goes down. It's normally what's going to happen, though. The architect's going to say, well, yeah, the price is going to go down, but I have to still make changes, but maybe not go down that much because you have to pay me to make the changes. And the schedule's not going to change at all because I still have to design something. Now I've got to change everything. That's going to take time, too. So a lot of times what the subtraction call a deductive change order doesn't always make it cheaper. I mean, if you remove a whole wing of a building, it may make the building cheaper, but it doesn't always change it that way. But you do not have to sign a new contract. So, okay? 1.3. The parties shall agree on the protocols for governing the transmission and use of the instruments of service. Remember I talked to you about the instruments of service. So we have all these electronic documents. You guys are creating on the CAD, you're doing designs, you're doing sections, you're doing elevations, you have all these drawings and the specifications. How does that information get communicated from the architect to the owner or from the architect to the contractor or the contractor to the subcontractors? You know, obviously you can print them out and there's always going to be hopefully a printed set on the project site for everybody to look at. But in this day and age, we do everything electronically. So lo and behold, between the 2007 and the 2017 version, they added in another E-series document, E, shockingly, electronic, it's an electronic document system, E203, that allows you to use building information modeling, BIM, I don't know if you guys have heard about BIM, and the digital data exhibit. Digital data means you're going to be transferring the information back and forth digitally. And so what this says is to the parties, let's establish what the protocols, the rules are in transmitting documents back and forth. What happens if the architect, and this very situation that came up yesterday, I told them in an arbitration, I can't tell you anything about it, but I can tell you exactly what happened to this specific issue. What happens if you transmit a document and not all the information goes? So the contractor gets a document, and it's got the drawings on it, and it's got some places got specifications, and you build off of that drawing, and you find out, because I know you guys have all seen this, like there's specs that are written. Sometimes it's a change, there's a bubble around it. But on the drawings, there's information about how to build that. What happens if it gets transmitted and not all the data comes with it? Who's responsible? How do you check that? That's what the protocols govern. And the reason why I said it came up in one of our cases is there's a series of drawings for one element in the project where we as the lawyers, because it's many years later, obviously in litigation and everything else, we've been working off a set of documents that have what we didn't know was that it was missing information. And we found out yesterday in the hearing that the site, so all the lawyers, all the questions and everything else have been based on these documents that we all felt were deficient. So the fingers were pointing at the architect. You didn't finish your drawings. And that made the contractor have to kind of wing it. And the building didn't work right. And that's part of the lawsuit. And so that's been the thrust of one element. Not the whole case. It's just one piece of this case. Because we felt that the drawings were deficient. We found out yesterday, when the architect was being on the stand, that the actual completed drawings with all the information were given to the architect on the project site. And they were not deficient drawings. But when they were transmitted to us, luckily it didn't happen on the project, but when they were transmitted to the lawyers, there was a digital failure. And so it's really interesting that this came up because in this case, it actually, we're the owner of the case, it actually helps our case because the contractor had all the information. The contractor's like going, I didn't know what I was doing because I didn't have the information. Well, the truth is they actually had the information. It's just the lawyers didn't. But you can't have scenarios, I'm living it right now, where the digital data didn't come across. It was a plotting, it was something with the when it was being transmitted electronically. It happens. So this provision here, 1.3, is real and important, and it tells the parties what to do to make sure you check the proper data has been transmitted. You know, when the document is uploaded to the website, the project website, Procore is one you use, there's other ones out there, when it's loaded to the project website, who's supposed to check that it was properly loaded? Who's responsible for confirming that? How do you do the confirmation? So, 1.3.1, any use of or reliance on, and that's the issue, is what do you rely on when you build it? Well, a portion of the building model without agreement, the protocols. If you decide, 1.3.1 says, if we don't use the protocols, if we don't create protocols in 1.3, we decide not to use those, the information contained in the model without having the protocols set forth in this document, we'll skip down, shall be at the using or relying party's sole risk and now without the liability to the other party and its contractors or consultants. So let's say this. Let's say we enter into an agreement and we don't use protocols. We don't say what happens if the data didn't come properly. That's what 1.3.1 says. When the contractor receives these drawings and if they're deficient, what this says in the second part of this that's highlighted, it's up to the contractor to figure it out. And if the contractor uses drawings without checking to make sure they're complete, it's the contractor's fault. Because you guys all agreed not to use protocols. If the protocols were in place, it could be that the architect was at fault. But in this instance, it says, without risk and liability to the other party or consultants, the authors or contributors to the building, it's not my fault, it's your fault. You got to check the math. So this one puts the responsibility on the receiving party. The relying party, that's what they call. I'm relying on you to give me proper information. They put the burden on the relying parties to make sure it's proper. So, the interesting thing, again, it's not relevant in our case because the actual proper information did get to the project site. That's what we've been able to determine thus far. But we were using a 97 version, which has none of this information in. So had there been this error in digital data at the project site, that would have been one of the issues of the case. Who's responsible? Is the architect? Is it the contractor? Who has to take the blame here if the drawings were deficient? So, any questions on this? That's it for initial information. That's the important stuff that you need to do. It's who, what, and price, or not price, but you know, who's going to be, who are the parties, what's the project, and then how are we going to communicate the information? That's the initial information you want to decide. The interesting thing about this part of the contract, when I negotiate this, there's a lot of this stuff actually you don't even know. Like when I have this, and you can sign this contract without having identified who the additional consultants are. You know in the future that somebody may be hiring the audiovisual team or the security team. You know that, but you don't fill it in. You can fill that in later through a change order. You can say, I'm adding this to, we're going to add this HVAC person or this NEP or the AV person or what have you. So some of the initial information doesn't get filled out. It's not that meaning you can't sign the contract. It just means not a lot of information is available at the very, very beginning of this linear process. Question?
Yeah, so is there a deadline for when they're due
to start? Good question. Is there a deadline for when it's due? The answer is no, kind of. So there's never, you don't put in a true hardline deadline. But what can happen is, if there's drawings that need to be created, if there's information that the owner needs to provide to the architect, like I have a budget of $1 million for this building, and because that often goes into your initial information, if you don't provide that budget information, the architect may be designing a $2 million building instead of a $1 million building. So what ends up happening is, when the additional information has been provided, here's the name of my HVAC consultant, or here's the budget, or whatever that is, it could affect how long it takes for the project to be built. So, if I haven't provided the budget, and I give a budget, and the architect was on a different page, and the architect's like, wait a minute, I have to redesign, and it's going to be longer, the owner's responsible for that, because they didn't give the things timely. Or the flip side is, if the architect hasn't provided hasn't secured or hired the consultant timely, and it starts to take longer, then he comes to the owner and says, hey, can I get another month because I still have to design this part? The owner's going to say to him, no, you don't get another month because you should have secured that before. So there's not a defined deadline. It depends on the circumstances where it could have a cost impact, schedule impact, or otherwise. Okay? All right. Article 2. Architect's responsibilities. So the architect, so like I said, each article is going to talk about it. This is what the architect has to do. This is the rules that the architect has to follow on. Kind of one of the things I say off and on throughout the class is going to say, the contract, the written contract is like when you, I don't know if any of you guys play board games, we play board games with my family, and my wife is very much a rule person. She's very stretching rules. So she pulls out, like even if we're playing Chutes and Ladders or whatever the game might be, she always reads the rules before we start. You know, like we have Harry Potter Clue. We love playing Clue, but Harry Potter Clue has these like different things where the rooms can spin and this and that. And so she gets out the rules and reads them. That's what a contract is. It's just the rules to Harry Potter. It's the rules of Monopoly. It gives you the rules of the game. So these are the rules that the architect needs to play by. 2.1. The architect shall provide professional services. We already talked a little bit about professional services, as set forth in this agreement. Now, remember we talked about the standard of care, which we'll talk about in a second. Standard of care is what happens in all society. Remember we talked about the law wants to make sure we're all conforming to society and everything else. That is true. But this one says, set forth in this agreement. Not another agreement, not somewhere else. It's in what's called, they call it the four corners of the agreement. You can't put other obligations on anybody if it's not, if you have a contract, other than what's in the four corners of the agreement. So they say that straight out. Hey, these are the rules to the game we're playing. These are the rules to this Monopoly game. The architect is properly licensed, and they're going to provide the services required of the agreement. Pretty basic. But properly licensed is important. The last thing you want to do is have someone be designing your space that's not licensed. I got a call on Wednesday from a gentleman in California. He called me up and said, hey, I listen to your lectures from time to time. I've talked to a bunch of people. Nobody can give me the answer. Can you help me out? I just got married and my wife owns some property, so how does that affect me? And I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And I asked him a few more questions, more questions, more questions. Ultimately, it turns out he graduated from architecture school. He designed. He's not licensed. And apparently, he's been doing multi-unit homes for people. He's been designing homes, and people have been building them. I'm like, what? I'm like, okay. And what his question was is, now that he's married, he was worried because one of our lectures we're going to talk about business relationships, the difference between a sole proprietorship and a corporation and an LLC, and how do you protect your interests. And he had heard me talk about how do you protect if you get sued and you lose in a case, they can't take your car and your house because it's personal property. So he's asked me about that because he didn't want them to take his wife's property. And I said, forget your wife's property right now. I don't know the laws in California, so I'm not going to give you advice, but I'm pretty sure if you are designing spaces that are being built for people to live in, you are acting illegally. And I think you need to go find someone that's a licensed architect. So, because this contract says, and if you have a franchise contract, you got to have somebody that's licensed, okay? Now, I will say that there are other areas, like when I was in law school, I helped pay for law school by doing design services for people. I did interior work, like how to lay out, you know, where, like, I helped somebody, one of my friends was, he owns a sausage and meat company in Detroit. And he had a store where you would go in and you could buy deli meat and link sausages and everything else. And he's like, Mike, can you help me do the redesign? Well, like, I redesigned how his floor tiles were and what the casings were going to be like. I didn't do any structural stuff. You can do that. But you didn't need to be licensed for something like that because there was no structural. But if you're building, like he said, I'm like, I'm doing multi-unit housing. I'm like, stop. I'm like, okay, I can't advise you other than to stop doing that. And then I said, good luck. So, okay, so that's 2.1. 2.2, it was bizarre. It was like I said, like happened 2 days ago. I'm like, oh, I'm going to be talking to students about being licensed next on Friday. So, 2.2, this is in blue. The reason why this is in blue is because this is one of the most important provisions of your entire career. And we talked about it already. You're going to perform your services. This is the standard of care one. And remember, standard of care is this negligence thing. It's this thing that is all society and everything else. So what they did was, we are going to make you contractually obligated to perform to the standard of care. So now it's a contract term. The concept of the standard of care is acting because society wants you to be careful and how you're supposed to act in society. So we stick it into a contract and now you're contractually obligated to perform in accordance with standard of care. Okay, so this combination of things. Perform the services consistent with the professional skill and care, so you're professional, skill and care ordinarily. So remember, you're an ordinary professional, not an extraordinary professional, not a special professional, not a high professional. You're just an ordinary professional. So you have been raised one level above the normal Jane and Joe because you're a professional, but you're not higher than every other professional. So ordinarily provided by architects practicing in the same or similar locality. So when you're building a house in Illinois, you don't have to follow the earthquake codes of California or whatever might be in other areas. Same or similar locality under the same or similar circumstances. If you're building a $100,000 tract home or you're building a $4 million home in the northern suburbs, they are going to be separate, different circumstances. So the standard of care of what you're going to be doing in your design and the services you're providing for the $4 million house versus the $100,000 tract home are going to be different. Okay? That's how you're judged. That is the standard care. Oh, and then it's consistent with such professional skill and care orderly in the orderly progress of work. So you got to make sure you're kind of following the rules of how you do it orderly. So that's your standard care. And that's going to be, there'll be questions on the standard care, that even on the exam, but independent of that, that's your mantra of what you're going to do for the rest of your career. I'm an ordinary professional architect. I'm designing in the same or similar locality, and it's of the same and similar circumstances. And that's going to be in every architectural contract you'll ever have. And if it's not in there, you need to put it in there. Because what will happen is they're going to ask you to be something more, or they're going to expect something more. So this is a protection for you as much as it is a guideline and a rule you have to follow in the contract. Okay? 2.3, you should identify a representative. Remember when we were back up in the initial information and said the architect shall provide a representative as stated in Article 2? Well, here's where it says in Article 2 you've got to name the representative. 2.4, except with the owner's knowledge and consent, the architect shall not engage in any activity or accept any employment interest that would reasonably appear to compromise the architect's professional judgment. The owner can't ask you to design something that would put you in a position that would be illegal or against code or otherwise. You're like, wow, why should this provision be in? Well, again, there probably was litigation sometime in the last 50 years that the architect was stuck because the owner forced them to do something, and the architect was like, I don't want to do this, and then the owner sued him because he wasn't delivering on the contract. So, are you going to be designing an illegal space? Is he going to force you to design a commercial building that's going to be in a residential space or a residential zoning area, some things like that? The owner can't force you to compromise your professional judgment and services. Okay? That's a protection for you. There are many, because this is designed or written initially by the AIA, the American Institute of Architects, there are many protections for architects in here. But what also you need to know is that, as I said, they're updated every 10 years. There's a committee that works to update the agreement. The committee is made up of not just architects. There are representatives from owners, contractors, subcontractors, the government, corporations. There's various entities that have a vested interest in this. Interestingly enough, because the American Institute of Architects has a large presence in Chicago, there's a bunch of lawyers that I know that meet there's 1 month every Wednesday, and they work on these agreements. So it's not like it's year 9 and we got to redo it. It's not like in 2026 they're going to sit down and say, how do we fix this agreement? They actually meet every month for 10 years, and they start working and tweaking. And what happens in those discussions, because I have a couple good friends that are on the committee, is they read cases, and they talk about provisions that work or don't work. They decide, we modified this provision in 2017. Here's what's the fallout of that spin over the last 5, 6, 7 years. Should we tweak the language, or is it working as we intended? So as we talk about it, I will point out provisions that will be architect-friendly. I'm going to point out a provision that's owner-friendly, and you'll know why it was stuck in, or contractor-friendly. So, and you'll see that throughout all the suite of the AAA documents. Okay, 2.5. The architect shall maintain the following insurance until termination of the agreement, and then we'll go through all the different insurance. We will have an insurance lecture, specifically the types, what they mean, so I'll just go through and identify them here, but we don't have to worry about today the details of insurance. It gets more complex. But the point here is, this is again an architect-friendly thing you want to have, but it's also good for the owner. It's that, if we're going to design and build this project, owner, you need to have insurance. You need to carry insurance on this project, because if something goes wrong, and it's your fault, I may get sued as the architect, and then I got to use my insurance, even if it's your fault, the owner. So this just says, hey, owner, carry insurance for your project. It's a good business thing anyway, but you need to carry it. One part is called commercial general liability. Again, I'm just going to name what they are because we'll have a detailed lecture on more specific later on. But commercial general liability, auto liability, excess or umbrella, so it's even more on top of those. Workers' compensation if somebody gets injured, one of your employees, employer's liability. The most important one here for you as the architect is what's called professional liability insurance. That covers you if you as the architect commit negligence or malpractice. This is effectively malpractice insurance. So that's something that needs to be covered and carried. Additional insurance obligations. So there may be, the architect may have other insurance that they want to carry that or have, and so the owner can ask those for the architect to carry as well. Okay. The architect shall provide certificates of insurance to the owner. And I'm going to back up really quickly. I was talking about in the very first thing I said on 2.5, I think I said the word owner. I meant the architect here. This is all the insurance the architect wants to carry. I apologize if there was some confusion there. But again, all the same, we'll talk about it in more detail in another lecture. And that's it. That's your basic scopes. That's the basic initial requirements of the architect. That's what you have to do. You have to have insurance. You have to make sure you identify an owner's rep. Those are the things. That's the architect's requirements. Now, Article 3 talks about, okay, we know who the architect is, we know who the owner is, we know the architect's requirements, we know the price, we know the style of project, etc., etc. But what am I going to do? What is the architect going to do? The scope of the basic services. Remember, basic services, because it only includes architectural, electrical, mechanical, and structural before. Not the extra stuff. It's just the basic services. So what do I do as an architect? What am I really giving to you, owner, for the $50,000 you're paying me for? That's what Article 3 talks about. It talks about the scope of what I'm going to provide. Okay? Now, architect basic services consisted in these Article 3 is includes usual and customary. Now, again, kind of going back to that standard of care concept. Not extraordinary, not something unique or anything else. If it's unique and different, you need to point that out. This is just the usual and customary structural, mechanical, electrical engineering services and the design services. And services not set forth in Article 3, so if it's not in this article, are supplemental, and it's supposed to say or, supplemental or additional services. Sorry, there's a typo over there. I just realized that. Not supplemental, are supplemental or additional services, okay? So we have the usual and customary, and Article 3 and everything in Article 3 covers that under its umbrella of what you're going to perform. If there's something else than your usual structural, mechanical, electrical, and your design stuff, if there's something else, that we're going to talk about in Article 4, which is called supplementary and additional services, okay? And the AIA as an organization is smart, and we'll talk more detail when we get to Article 4, but you're going to see that the additional supplementary services is kind of like a laundry list. It's a place where the architect can say, yeah, I can design a space for building for you, but here's all the other stuff I can get you. And that gives the architect an ability to charge more money. Because supplemental and additional services, you should get paid for something that's an additional. You should get paid for something that's supplemental. And so you can charge more for that. So it's a business tool as well. And we'll see that. I'll show you the laundry list when we get there of all the different types you can provide. Okay? 3.1.2. The architect shall coordinate its services with those services provided by the owner and the owner's consultants. Well, what does that mean? You're hired to design a hotel. The owner wants this really splashy, nice, beautiful hotel. It's a boutique, so we're not talking about the Marriott or some national flag. It's just a nice, cool boutique hotel that you're going to build in the city of Chicago. And the owner's really big. He's a big foodie, and he has relationships with people, and maybe he knows somebody that won Top Chef or something on the Food Network, okay? And so he, the architect, or the owner, he enters into a deal with somebody, one of the top chefs on the TV show, and says, will you be my star restaurateur? And we will build you on the first level of my hotel, this splashy, cool restaurant. And the winner from Top Chef, she says, yes, of course. Like there's one here in Chicago, Stephanie Izar, if you ever eaten at the Girl and the Goat or a couple of the restaurants. So Stephanie says, yes, of course, I would love to do that with you. I want to make sure we design it the way I want it, blah, 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 blah. And the owner's like, perfect, let's get into a deal. And now we have a restaurateur, a restaurant designing company. And the owner has retained them, not the architect. So the architect designs this hotel and leaves this space right in the middle of the front first level so you can have this splashy, cool restaurant that Stephanie Izar is going to be the top chef and draw people in and everything else. That's the owner's consultants because the owner has hired a kitchen designer. And so what this provision says is the architect has to coordinate its services with those provided by the owner and the consultant, meaning these two parties have to work together. And coordination means because as the architect of the main space, they're going to have this box on the floor plan on the first level that's going to say, this is where Stephanie's restaurant's going to go. But they have to show where the electrical's coming in, where the mechanical's coming in, what the structural is, because remember, they are designing the whole space. So they have to coordinate, the architect must coordinate with the owner's kitchen architect and show them where the connections are. That's what coordination is, making sure that things match up, okay? So that's what this provision says. It immediately starts to show cooperation, who's responsible for what. Now, the architect shall be entitled to rely on. So now we have the kitchen designer that the owner has hired. And so the architect should be able to rely on and shall not be responsible for the accuracy, completeness, or timeliness of the service or information provided by the owner and the owner's consultants. So if the architect says to my kitchen designer, what do you need? What kind of voltage do you need? What kind of amperage do you need? What plumbing do you need? What kind of ventilation do you need? And we, and my kitchen designer gives a laundry list of A, B, C, D, E, F, and G of what they need. The architect designing the whole space is allowed to rely on that. It's not the architect's responsibility to do the math, to check the details that are being provided to the architect from my kitchen designer. So, yes, I have to coordinate and make sure I can show where all the connections are for the electrical and the plumbing and the structural, I as the architect, but I'm allowed to rely on you. And if something goes wrong, and it turns out that the kitchen architect gave the wrong information, and now the main architect has to redesign, the main architect should get paid for that redesign because they relied on what the owner's kitchen architect told them to do. Okay? And the owner should go back to the kitchen architect and say, you pay their fees because you screwed up. I shouldn't have to pay for it either. I'm just an owner. I'm just a guy that wants to build the hotel, and I really like Stephanie Eisner, so I hired her to put in her girl or goat too, or whatever it is. So that's what you want. That's what this provision talks about. And then it says, however, so this is this first part. This is one of these where I talk about how there's different people on the teams that create the AIA contract documents. This provision in the beginning is clearly architect favored because it says, I, architect, am not responsible for what you, owner, give me. I got to rely on what you, I got to trust you, owner. It's not my fault. It's your fault. That part of this provision is favorable to the architect. But during these negotiations that happen every Wednesday, one Wednesday every month for the period of 10 years before we get the next provision out, some owner said, wait a minute, yeah, you're right, but what happens if you saw something and you didn't say anything? I got to have some protection too as the owner, so now we have this other part. The architect should provide prompt written notice to the owner. This puts an obligation on the architect. Even though it says, hey, it's not my fault, I can rely on the accuracy, it says, I shall provide prompt written notice if the architect becomes aware of any error, omission, or inconsistency in what's being provided. So the kitchen architect gives a whole bunch of information to the architect, and the architect's allowed to rely on it. But if the architect is kind of doing it, looking at it, says, this doesn't make any sense. The architect can't bury its head in the sand. If they become aware, they need to provide prompt notice. They raise their hand and they tell the owner, your kitchen architect screwed up. I don't have to fix it. They do. But if I don't tell you and I knew about it, then maybe I have to. Maybe I don't get paid for a redesign, or maybe there's both parties are at fault. So this is this prompt written notice, and it's written notice. It's not just a call on the phone. I got to write down, hey, I saw this. Your kitchen architect screwed up here because I became aware of it. And, go ahead, question. Meaning, how is it? What's your question mean by how is it enforceable? What do you mean by that? Excellent question. That's exactly where I was going to go with that. So the question is, how is it enforceable? Like, how do you do it? It's not about the enforceability per se. It's about what happens when something goes wrong. What are the proofs to show? And the reality is exactly what you said. Should there, you have to show two things. And one is very difficult. If there's no written record of it, then you are in a he said, she said situation where the architect's like, I didn't become aware. I don't know what you're talking about. Maybe they did, and then you would have to get testimony that, yes, we do, and there was discussion, and you could maybe draw it out and say, hey, architect, you had a job to give written notice, and you failed to. But you have to prove, and sometimes it's proving a negative, because the architect's like, I knew nothing. I didn't know. And so that's the difficulty with a provision like that. What I do, and we're not even going to, I don't put any of this information in the exam, there are many provisions in this document that I modify. So when I say becomes aware of any event, when I see that I say becomes aware or should have become aware, I put a standard of care, a reasonableness factor in this, because then I can say, because the architect can say, didn't know, and then you're stuck. And then I can come back and say, but you should have known, and that's fair and reasonable. So if I'm representing an owner, I modify the contract to be more favorable for the owner in the situation. If I was an architect, I would leave it alone. But how you ultimately prove it in court, you would have to show that the architect actually became aware. And that's a difficult proof sometimes. So, any other questions on that? Yes. Great question. Is there a similar provision for the contractor? And the answer is yes. And when we get to the A201, I'm going to point those out. There are many mirror or really close to mirror provisions between the the architect agreement and the contractor agreement. I don't remember, and I will get there. Like, I know every one of these provisions by the back of my hand, but as I sit here and I know that there's 120 slides, I don't remember if we have the exact one in this. But the answer is yes. There is language that the contractor, if they become aware of something, they got to raise their hand too. Again, the whole concept when we enter into these contracts and everything is you want to have a good, happy marriage and a good relationship between all the parties. When things go south, that's when disputes come and they hire me, but you want to make sure, and one of the ways you do that is encourage communication and cooperation, and so you add provisions in here that says, hey, I get to rely on what you said, and I'm protected, and then the owner says, yeah, but if you see something, you got to do something. See something, say something. So that promotes cooperation. Yes, but yes, there is that. There are specific provisions in the owner contract agreement. I will point those out. If they come up in here, I'll say this is where it is. So, great question. 3.1.3. As soon as practicable after the date of this agreement. So there are some. Remember, you asked about timing and everything else. As soon as practical, the architect shall submit for the owner an approved schedule. How long is it going to take for me to do all this? And it shall, we'll go further down, shall include anticipated dates for the commencement of the construction. I'm going to design, it's going to take me 9 months to design, but we expect building to start construction on August 1st or whatever it might be. And for substantial completion of the work. If you see the word substantial completion, S and C are capitalized. That's a defined term. Now, it's ultimately defined, substantial completion is ultimately defined in the owner-contractor agreement. It has very important legal ramifications as to what the contractor does. But what you're asking here for the architect is, tell me when we're going to start building and tell me we're going to be finishing building. Because the owner wants to know, when do I have my construction loan kicked in? When do I need to make sure my permits are in place? When do I need to sure actually that I need to have a contractor on board? And then that's the beginning commencement. And the substantial completion is when the owner can start to move in and start using the building. When can I start making my toys? When can I start bringing in people to my hotel? When can the building, if it's a profitable, profit-making building, when can it actually start generating revenue for me? So that's why it's very important for the architect in the very beginning of this long process to say, hey, we're going to take 9 months to design, it's going to take 16 months to build, and then you're off and running. And so the architect has to put together the schedule. Jumping further down in this, it says, once approved by the owner, so that's the schedule, time limits established by the schedule shall not, except for reasonable cause, be exceeded by the architect or the owner. So that schedule is going to have a whole bunch of dates in it. It's not just necessarily going to be start and finish. They're going to have dates of when I'm going to give you drawings and when you have to approve, and when I'm going to give you another set and you're going to have to approve. There's going to be this back and forth dialogue between owner and architect. And it goes to your question of when I'm going to make sure I have the information on my budget there timely. When am I going to have the drawings for the schematic designs or the design development? When are those going to happen? And so that schedule is going to be in there. And it says, they shall not be exceeded. So when you get to this point and the schedule is created, sometime after the execution, as soon as practicable, you have the schedule in place, then you're going to start to have some dates locked down. Not during the initial information, but sometime pretty soon, because time is money on construction projects. Schedules are really important. So, you can't exceed that, except for reasonable cause. Reasonable cause is I changed my building, so now I got to hire new people. So then you can change the schedule. It's going to be bigger, smaller. It's going to be whatever you need to do. It may be that we turn out that as the architect is starting to do stuff and you do soil samples, it turns out that the soil is really bad. Oh my God, now I got to have, instead of having your normal footings, I got to have piles that go down to bedrock. That's going to totally change my design. In fact, I had a Walgreens as well. There was an owner, a guy, it was a nice gentleman. He and his family owned like throughout the country like 30 Walgreens and Kmarts and those types of buildings. And they didn't own the Walgreens, they owned the building that Walgreens leased from them. So they were an owner of a drugstore or whatever. This was down in Streeter, Illinois. Streeter, Illinois, and there's a number of places down in Illinois, have all these underground natural mines. And over years and over time, as water goes and everything else, it erodes away the ground beneath. And I got a call from this gentleman, really, the nicest guy in the world. I don't know how he got my name. And he's like, can you help me? My building is sinking. And literally, the building was like sinking and going down. And we had to go in. The building had been there for 20 years, but the erosion had started to come away, and there was soil and everything going in. And we had to drive micropiles 200 feet down to find bedrock. And so you had to fix stuff. That was something. Granted, the project was already, obviously, the hotel, the Walgreens was up and running for years, so it wasn't a construction schedule there. But you could have that in the beginning of project, where it finds out your soil is bad, so you've got to drive micropiles or whatever you need to do. That will change the schedule because it's fair and reasonable. Okay? So the big takeaway of this is there's going to be a schedule. The architect has to create it, and then everybody has to follow it. That's kind of what this provision says in 313. 314. The architect shall not. The word shall, by the way, in legal terms, means must. You have to do it. It is a requirement. You can't say, oh, I didn't know if I wanted to do it or not. Shall, here, so shall not be responsible for an owner's directive of substitution or for the owner's acceptance of non-conforming work made or given without the architect's written approval. What does that mean? 314 says, and this is when the construction is already going on, if the owner walks on the site and the contractor says, hey, we changed something here, or this is how we built it, are you okay with that, owner? So the owner is the ultimate decision maker here. And she's like, yeah, looks fine to me. This provision says, hey, if you, owner, made a decision that was different from my drawings and the building falls down, or different from my drawings, you don't like it later, I'm not responsible because you accepted non-conforming work. I got drawings that say it should look like this. You were out in the field and you accepted something different. Not my problem. You're the owner. You ultimately make the decision. That's not on me. So, it's protection to the owner. As the architect here. Because owners can do that. They are very active owners. They come in and make their decisions all the time. And the architect's like, sometimes they don't even know. The architect doesn't even know the owner made the decision. So this is, you know, simple, but there have been owners that have sued architects when walls have fallen down or whatever happened because the owner made a decision the architect didn't know about. This provision says, not my fault, your fault. 315. This talks about governmental authorities. You need permits, you need to make sure you're in the right zoning, whatever. And this, the important part here says, the architect shall respond to applicable design requirements imposed by those authorities and entities. As a very basic, if it's an industrial site, you can't design commercial in there. But more importantly, if it's a commercial site and you're designing a commercial space, but it requires a setback, has to be so far off the street sidewalk, or after it goes up to a certain height, there needs a setback because they want light infiltrating. So all these different things that happen with codes and requirements, the architect has to comply with that. If there's a snow load, the architect has to comply with those requirements because the government has required that. If there's an earthquake situation, all of those, and this basically says, hey, if the government or there's a law that says you have to comply with that architect, you need to comply with that. Again, it's logical and makes sense, but it's in here because somewhere along the line, some architect or some owner wasn't clear about what they were supposed to do here. Now we know. You got to follow the rules of the government with your design. And then 316, the architect shall assist the owner in connections with the owner's responsibility for filing documents required for approval of government authorities. Most of the time, the owners have no idea. It's a one-off project. They don't know what to do. They don't know who to call in the building department. They don't know what forms to fill out. So this just says, architect, you need to assist them. And you get paid for it. You can charge them an hourly rate for it. But that's what your job is as the overall helping the owner get this building built. Help them fill out the forms to get the permits and stuff. Okay. 3.2. Now we're going to get into the services, the actual services the architect's going to perform. There are five basic services that you're going to do. Schematic design, design development, construction documents, that's the actual plans and specs that the building can be built from. Procurement and negotiation, if you're going to actually, when you're going to bring in a contractor. And then construction administration. We'll go through all five. And it's all specifically spelled out in here. Not all projects Does the architect provide all services? Sometimes they won't help out with the procurement and hiring a contractor. Sometimes they don't do construction administration on the back end and they don't walk the project site. So normally it's 4 and 5 that can be stricken. Sometimes they add. Sometimes there's a programming phase before schematic design. At the end of the semester, I'm going to give you guys all a form contract that you can use. Lots of it's based on the B101, but it's shorter. And it's going to have 7 phases instead of 5. Because why not give you a few more to use when you go out and practice as an architect? You can use it and put it in your drawer and never use it again. Or you can use it if you ever want to hang your own shingle. But so these are the basic traditional services, the 5, but that doesn't mean you have to do all 5. So we'll talk about schematic design. So the first is the architect shall review the program. The program's like we're building this school, and the school's going to have 75 classrooms, and it's going to have a gym, and it's going to have a pool, blah, blah, blah. That's the program. And other information furnished by the owner. And then the architect shall also review laws, codes, and regulations applicable to the services. Yeah, I can design the school, and here are all the things I need to include in the school. You know, does each classroom have to have, sadly in those days, does each classroom have to have a safe room? Or whatever you want to call it, like, a, you know, for purposes of where we live nowadays. But that's what the architect has to do right out of the bat. Look at the program and then figure out what laws are going to apply so I can design the building. Second, 3.2.2. The architect shall prepare a preliminary evaluation of the owner's program schedule, budget for the cost of the work, project site, and the proposed procurement and delivery method. So what does that mean? The preliminary evaluation, I'm going to take, because I sat down with the owner, there's going to be, throughout your career, you're going to have a lot of times you're going to sit down in a room with a client, especially if you're doing things like residential or small retail, and the client's just going to talk to you. This is what I want. I want this 3-bedroom, 3-bath house. I want a porch. I want a deck. I like blue. You know, I want really nice windows. I like open space. That's what I want. You're going to get all these things. You're going to be like, you have no idea what you're talking about, but you are the trained professional. You're going to hear all this information. You're going to write it all down. And then you're going to give it back to them, and they're like, oh my God, this is exactly what I was saying, except it's going to be in your language now. That's what you're going to do. You're going to take their, I really like blue, and you're going to put it on paper to say, this is what it's really, what you're really asking for. It's an evaluation. But you're also going to talk about schedule. This, you know, from what we hear, this is how long it's going to take. It's preliminary evaluation schedule. And what's your cost? What's your budget? How much you want to spend? I want to spend $200,000. Okay, we're not doing what you think you're doing for $200,000. Let's talk about here's what $200,000 will get you, or if you want what you really want, it's going to be $500,000. You're going to help them with that. That's the preliminary stuff, okay? And it works to fill in the initial information, because like some of the stuff you don't have in the beginning after you talk to them, but that's what you're going to do. Procurement and delivery method is how is it going to be paid for? Like, is the contractor going to be doing, how the contractor is going to bid and so forth on that. And then the architect shall notify the owner of any inconsistency discovered in the information or other information or consulting service that may be needed. So if the architect, the owner comes and says, I want to spend $200,000, I want to do all this stuff, the architect's going to say, you can't do it for $200,000. Or, I really want this house to be this way. Well, you can't do it in this neighborhood because the law doesn't allow that. So that's what the second half of this is. It's this introduction and you providing your beginning of your professional services to help guide the architect, the owner, to what the project ultimately can be. Okay? 3.2.3. The architect shall present its preliminary evaluation to the owner, and the architect shall reach an understanding with the owner regarding the requirements of the project. So it's like, okay, this is what you want. This is when you took the, I really like blue, and you put it into a proposal to them, a form, and you guys both agree. Yes, this is what I want. This is what I was saying. Okay, now we're on the same page. This is the beginning of making sure you have an agreement of what that project is going to be. And then based on the project requirements, they shall prepare and present for the owner approval a preliminary design. Oh, here's some sketches of what this house is going to be. And you colored the door blue, whatever you needed to do to give her the blue. And that's going to be the part of this preliminary schematic design as you start giving them some things. Maybe there's some initial floor plans, or maybe they're just bubble diagrams. Maybe they're just traffic patterns and flows. It kind of depends on what the communication is and what's the client wanting. It's a back and forth process in there. 3.2.5. Based on the approval of the preliminary design, those sketches, those bubble diagrams, the traffic patterns, the flows, We're now going to prepare a set of schematic design drawings. They're going to be more fleshed out. It's not going to be just rough sketches. And that schematic design shall include a site plan, if appropriate. Hey, here's your lot, your plot, where it's going to be. The building's going to be in this corner, that corner, the building, middle, whatever it is. And preliminary, if appropriate, preliminary building plans, sections, elevations. So now we can actually see what it's going to look like. It's not just bubbles. It's actually kind of a more detailed. There's no dimensioning. There's no details of how wall sections are or anything else. It's just to give the owner more flesh to what the building's going to look like. Say, oh, you know what? It's kind of like what I like, but now that I see it on paper, maybe you could do this, this, and this. So that's where you're at this process, schematic part. And it may include some combination of study models, perspective sketches, or digital representations. Here, look what we did on whatever CAD program we had. We're going to walk you through the space. I can't remember the name of the show on TV. I think it's on HGTV or whatever it is. It's the two brothers, and the twin brothers are like 6'4". One's an architect, the other's a builder. I can't remember what it's called. Property Brothers. Okay, so we know what it is. Okay, Property Brothers. And they always have, like, it's really cool. Like, I always watch it because they throw up, like, an iPad, and it's like, and it shows what the space is going to look like. That's what you're doing here. Like, you're going to give some stuff like that. And the tools available to you guys to do it now compared to when I was your age and stuff like that didn't exist. But that's what this is going to be. Like, what you see on Property Brothers or... what's the Chip and the other woman from them, the Magnolia? Chip and Anna. They have their stuff is all that stuff when you see those drawings and everything else. That's all schematic design. That's the phase they are. Maybe it's design development, but it's pretty basic. That's what you're going to be getting at the end of this phase. Okay. The architect shall consider sustainable designs. In the 2007, it didn't say shall consider. It said they may consider. Now they added to shall. So you are required to at least think about sustainable design. The owner can veto it, but you want to relate to them. Hey, you want to make sure I'm using green materials here, I got more light here, I got whatever the HVAC system I was using. So you need to at least consider it. It doesn't say you must use, you just need to consider it. So they want what the AIA is doing here is saying, we want to be green, we want to support green, but we're not forcing anybody to be green. That's the government's job to say you have to be green or not green. So shall consider, not is obligated to use. And then if you want more advanced sustainable design services, going back to the laundry list and the shopping list, I'm sorry, is we'll go to section 4.11. So you can say, hey, I considered some sustainable stuff. Do you like that? Owner's like, oh yeah, that's really cool. Okay, let's go to 411 and I can tell you how much more it's going to cost. Oh, I don't really do that. I don't want to spend more money. Maybe it's not so cool. But it's part. It's part of the dialogue. This is as much of importance for the green and our environment and as much as we're still a business model here. We're still making sure that everybody's getting paid for their services. 3252, the architect shall consider the value of alternate materials, building systems, and equipment. This is a concept called value engineering. So maybe there's a type of truss system that everybody uses in the industry that's just a little less expensive. You have an idea that's a little less expensive. So you can say, hey, I have an alternate material here. So you want to start considering ways maybe to be faster to build, easier to get, cheaper for the owner, but it still satisfies the requirements. I'll give you an example of what happened on one of my projects. If we go back to when we were in the throes of COVID, one of the areas that actually boomed was construction. There was lots of construction during COVID. Why? It's all outside. So people could work outside. So it was a huge, it actually helped to drive the economy for quite some time, construction. And as a result of that, and other things that were going on in countries throughout the world, getting lumber was astronomically expensive. It was more expensive to buy a 2x4 made out of wood than it was to buy a 2x4 made out of metal. And so we had a project that was underway that was a normal traditional balloon frame wood structure. And we went back to the architect and we said, what do we do about this? Because it was going to delay the schedule. And he considered value of alternate materials, and he said, I can get the same material made out of metal studs than wood studs. And so he changed the design. So that was the architect performing their obligations during the design phase to use a different material. Nowadays, the wood's much less expensive. It's come down, but that was a period of time when they had to consider something else. 3, 2, 6. So this is in blue, another one that's real important, just kind of overall. But I have this here because we already talked about the cost of the work. Remember I said it's going to be in Article 6? Well, this kind of talks about it again. But some of the language in here is from Article 6. So I highlight it here because we don't get to Article 6 in today's lecture. So we'll go through it here. The owner shall submit to the... I'm sorry, the architect shall submit to the owner under 3, 2, 6. Shall submit to the owner an estimate of the cost of the work. Now, if you remember a couple of paragraphs below, in the preliminary information the architect should provide to the owner, they used the word budget. Now they're using the word estimate. What's the difference between those? Anybody have a thought on what the difference is between budget and estimate for purposes of a construction project? That's really good. The budget, she said, is the budget a maximum, and is the estimate kind of what they thought is going to be? Very, very close. The budget is going to be what you always want to think about is the budget says the owner sets the budget. This is what I want to spend for the project, so it creates a maximum. And if the budget goes up, it's up to the owner to make that decision. The architect then designs to that budget, that maximum, $1 million. I'm not going to design a project more than $1 million, maybe give or take 10%, but we have to keep within that budget. And so as I'm designing, as I get to my end of my preliminary or my schematic design, I'm going to say, hey, I heard your budget was $1 million. I'm putting this stuff together. My estimate for what I designed is $950,000. I'm under your budget. This is what I think it will actually cost you, the cost of the work. Not my fees, not paying for the land, but the cost of construction, my estimate, is below your budget. Owner always has budget. Architect provides estimate. Okay? So you want to remember that. So it is both what you believe the actual cost will be is estimate, and the budget is the max, but also remember as to who does it. Owner, budget, architect provides the estimate. Okay? So when you get toward the end of your schematic design phase, you're going to give to the owner an estimate. And that's where the owner can say, oh, yeah, I see your $950,000. You're under my budget. That looks great, except for this is not the building I want. I wanted more. And then you tell the owner, well, then your budget needs to go up. If you want the gold plated faucets, you need a more budget. The owner's like, oh, I got to go back to my board of directors, see if I can get that. I have a project going on that right now. When I first got a call from the client, her budget was $1 million. We are now at $4 million because everything she wanted, and we started pricing it out, was it even remotely going to be at $1 million? So we're now at $4 million. She went back to her board, told them this, because the architect provided an estimate for what she wanted. It was way higher than the budget, and she got approval for that. So what I've done here is I plugged in the language in 6.1 and 6.3. So this is not under 2.6.3, 2.6, but this is so you can understand it. I fast forward it so you can understand it. So the cost of the work, the defined cost of the work, is the total cost of the owner to construct all elements of the project designed or specified by the architect and shall include the contractors, not the architects, general conditions, costs, overhead, and profit. So it is the building construction. That's the cost of the work. And you remember that defined term. The cost of the project includes the land, my fees, the architect's fees, the accounting fees, your carrying costs for your construction loan, all that other stuff. That's the cost of the project. But the cost of the work, capital W, work, is just to build the project as designed by the architect and includes the contractor's cost, overheads, and profit. 6.3 talks about the estimate, and it says the architect shall be permitted to include contingencies, so when they're doing their estimate, for design, bidding, and price escalation, because the price of lumber went up, and so you had to use steel studs, to determine what materials, equipment, component system, etc., are to be included in the contract documents. Contract documents, capital C, capital D, is what they build off of, what the whole project, what the whole contract is. To recommend any reasonable adjustments in the program of the scope of the project, and to include design alternates as necessary to adjust the estimated cost of the work. This second part about recommendations and reasonableness and change, when you give that estimate up here that's required under 326, is exactly the example that I was telling you about with my client with the initial $1 million budget, and now it's up to $4 million. When they sat down, the architect and the owner sat down and started talking about the scope, and we're going through all this preliminary stuff in the schematic, the wish list became much bigger than the budget. And so the architect had to give them this information and the alternates to make sure that the budget for the estimate would meet the owner's budget. The architect estimated cost of the work to meet the owner's budget. It allows for flexibility. 6.3 allows for flexibility. And it's not as radical as the example I just gave. We started with $1 million budget, now it's $4 million. A lot of times it's like you start with $1 million budget and it goes up to like 1.3 or 1.4. And so what may end up happening at the beginning, the early part of the schematic design phase that we're in here, this very first phase, you may come in with a $950,000 estimate and everybody's like, oh, that's really cool, we're good. And then as the project develops and more things come in, it goes to $1 million, then it goes to $1.1 million and $1.3 million. And 6.3 allows the architect to have that flexibility to change that as long as they keep the owner informed. Okay? 327. You're going to submit the owner, the schematic design drawings to the owner, and you're going to ask for their approval. Hey, do you like what I'm doing? I gave you the budget, or I gave you the estimate. Is it within your budget? Do you like what it looks like? If we approve, we can go to the next phase. What's important about this provision is requesting for the owner's approval. I've had cases where the architect didn't get the owner's approval, and they moved to the next phase, which is called design development, and they start working on design development, and then they send a bill to the owner for their services under design development, and they're like, I didn't give you green light to go forward. I'm still looking at your old stuff. I'm not sure if I like it. You can't bill me for that stuff. So you want to make sure, before you go to the next phase, you get approval. And so that's why the document says, shall submit and requests for the approval. You need to do that both. That's as much of a guideline and a protection for you as it is to make sure that the owner's on board. Okay? Phase 2, design development. This is 3.3. Architect shall prepare design development documents for the owner's approval. Hey, now we're going to do something more. Design development is going to be, you're going to take the schematic and you're going to flesh it out even more. And it's going to consist of drawings and other documents, including plans, section elevations, etc., diagramming layouts, that describe the size and character of the project as the architectural, structural, mechanical, and electrical systems and appropriate elements. If you remember, we didn't have in the schematic the structural, mechanical, and electrical systems reference. It's going to be plans, sections, and elevations in the schematic. Now we got to start showing where the electrical systems are going to be running through and everything else. So the design developments are taking the process one step further. And that's important because you're going to have to prepare an estimate. You're going to say, oh, I got this much linear feet of copper, or I'm going to have to pull this much wiring, or you're going to need this type of air conditioning and ventilation system. Now that has to fall into your estimate. Does it stay within the budget? So you're now fleshing things out more in design development. And if you want to think about, and we'll show this in the chart later on, but if you want to think about percentages, schematic design is somewhere between 15 to 20%. Design development is about, maybe schematic design is probably 10 to 15%. Design development is about 20% of the time. When you get into the construction document phases, that's like 40%, which we'll get there in a second. So this is about 20% of your time of the overall design process, is this design development, kind of getting things more detailed. You're going to update the estimate. I got more information. I got more detail. Am I still at 950 of the $1 million budget? Or am I at Have I been really good and now it's at 900? Or am I at 1.1? I have to give the owner this running estimate of what it's going to cost so the owner can make decisions. Yes, I want to keep this. Oh, we can add more. If we're 900,000, let's add some more things. You know, you give them, the owner, the chance to understand. And then, just like in the schematic design, you're going to submit the design development documents to the owner, advise of any adjustments to the estimate. Hey, we went from 950 to 900 bonus, or we went to 1.1 million. You need to tell them that. And once again, request the owner's approval. And all these are shall. You have to follow these steps. If you don't follow the steps, you can't come back later and say, oh, well, I thought I could go on to the next phase. Well, if you didn't ask for approval, you can't go to the next phase. Okay? Or you go to the next phase, you just may not get paid for it. Phase 3, construction document-based services. Like I said, this is about 40-45% of your time spent. These are the actual drawings that the contractor is going to use to build the space. These now will have dimensions. These will have section details. It's going to show where the insulation goes. It's going to show what a drip edge is, what flashing is, what a lintel is, how the ductwork is going to run. All these things. So you're going to have, because it's this set that the contractor is going to print out on and have on the project site. It's this set that, God forbid, doesn't get screwed up by digital data transmission problems. This is what the contractor and the subcontractors are going to use. So, you're going to prepare the construction documents for the owner's approval, and the construction documents shall illustrate and describe further development of the design development things, and shall consist of, and here's the first time you see this, capital D and capital S for drawings and specifications. Now, it's a defined term. Before, it was plans and sections and elevations and kind of describing the nature of the documents. Now we have a defined term of drawings and specifications, because in the contract with the contractor, they're going to say the drawings for the capital D are X, and it's going to list every single document they can use. And the specifications are Y, and it's going to say it's a spec book or where the specifications are going to be found. Because if there's a problem, you have to look at those capital D drawings and those capital S specifications and say, you didn't build it like it was drawn here. Or God forbid we get into a lawsuit and we say, you didn't build it and legally you had to. So this capital D and capital S is very important, and that's why it's a change from SD and DD phases. Now in CD phase, construction document phases, it's the defined term of what the project can be built. And it shall set forth in detail the quality levels and performance criteria of the materials and services, systems, and other requirements for the construction of the work. The quality criteria and performance criteria. What do we have to build it to? What level and standard? What do we have to follow? And that must be delineated in the drawings and specifications. I have a case where there's a lot of things that's not level, it's not straight, it's not square. The contractor that framed out the space, or maybe it was the drywall, or we don't know, we're still working through it, just did a poor job in constructing the space. They're taking the position, hey, I did my job, it's pretty standard, it's what I normally do, and the contractor paid me. If they had a problem with it, the owner paid me, if they had a problem with it, it's fine. And that's just the discussion back and forth. And then we pulled out the specifications. And the specification says specifically, all whatever the word language is, all whatever framing or whatever must be level and plumb. Plumb means if you hang a string down, it's straight up and down, it's not skewed, so the wall's not an angle. Level, obviously flat. And we're like, did you go through and make sure everything was level and plumb? He's like, well, I didn't walk around with a square or a plumb line and everything else. I'm like, so you didn't follow the specification. It's not just fine. So what we did, because the contractor was required by the contract to follow the specifications, capital S, we looked at the specifications, it identified the performance criteria, and as the attorney representing the owner, it's our position that they failed to follow the performance criteria. So cost that we need to incur to fix that has to be paid by this contractor. Okay? So this is really important. This is what you're going to use. This set is what the project's going to be built by. The owner and the architect acknowledge that in order to perform the work, the contractor shall provide additional information, including shop drawings, product data, sample, and other similar submittals, which the architect shall review. We'll talk about that in a minute, but shop drawings or submittals is like, architect draws in the specification, we want to use this type of brick. But it's not a picture of that brick. But they say the type of the brick. So the contractor needs to show up with samples that's listed there. Here are three bricks that fall into this type. Which color do you like? And then the architect reviews those and comes back and says, oh, I like this brick. Pick this brick for the building, even though they're all within that same field. So that's what happens. There is a give and take between contractor and owner on that, and architect. 3.4.2. The architect shall incorporate the design requirements of the governmental authorities having jurisdiction into the construction documents. Remember way back when in the schematic design phase, the architect had to look up and see what laws and codes and regulations apply to this drawing? They need to make sure they're written into the actual construction documents to tell the contractor, you need to follow these rules and laws. So if the architect fails to put in some instruction and the contractor doesn't follow those rules and laws, the architect could be held liable for it because they were required, shall incorporate into the design these governmental obligations. Okay, so you're forcing the architect to carry through. You already looked it up. You already made your design. You just got to make sure you tell the contractor to do it as well. Okay? And then 3.4.3 says, the development of the construction documents, these are what you build from, the architect shall assist the owner in the development and preparation, and there's a whole laundry list of various types of things. This is the contract and the things you're going to use for the contractor. So this is basically saying, hey, I'll help you put together the owner-contractor agreement. Because they're AIA documents anyway, I know them, I'm going to be fine, I'll help you with them. One word of advice, because I'm in the legal industry, you guys shouldn't be advising your owners on owner-contractor agreements, because you're not a lawyer, contractors are going to take advantage of you. What you should do when you assist the owner in the development of preparation, and I'm not saying this to get more business, because I have so much business I can't even see straight, I left my office at 2:30 last night. So I'm just saying, instead of telling your owner I'll help you draw the contract, what you tell your owner is, I can recommend you to a lawyer that'll help you draw your contract, so I don't get in trouble, and neither do you. But under the AIA, they're not saying that. The AIA says you should help architects, our owners out with how you develop your contracts and stuff. So that's just my side note. And again, people call me, that's fine. I'm always happy to help out. But that's not a pitch for me to get my business. That's just to keep you guys out of trouble. I've had projects where the architect has assisted the owner in that contract under that provision, and the contract's terrible, and the owner sued the architect. So a lot of times I try to give you advice to keep you guys from not having to call me because you got sued. You can call me for questions. By the way, anytime you guys are practicing for the rest of your lives, just call me up and say, hey, I had you for a class. I've had some people who are like, I'm like, oh yeah, I don't remember you, but I'm sure you, I've got you. She's like, can you help me this? And so I'm happy to do that for any of you guys the whole rest of your careers. If you ever have a question, I won't charge you, just call me up. If you want to hire me, that's fine. But yeah, like, Mike, what do I do about this? I'm always open for my classmates, all my students. I think it's anything I can do. So, okay, 3.4.4. Shocker, we got to update the estimate again. Here's my construction documents. We're going to build this from you. Now we're going to build. And it's like, are we still in budget? Yes, we are. Okay, bonus. Or we're a little bit over. That's okay. Whatever you need to do. But you can give the estimate, the cost of the work at the end of this phase. And then this is, you've seen this before. You're going to submit it. You're going to advise them of the estimate. And you're going to you're going to request the owner's approval. So, same thing. So at the end of each one of these phases, FD, CD, or FD, DD, and CD, is each phase, the same step. Update your budget, tell the owner what the new budget is, and make sure they approve of it. Any questions on those three phases? Okay. Procurement phase and services. That's phase 4. This is just assisting the owner in getting a contractor. Now, architects wade into this water at various levels. Some architects don't want to have anything to do with it. Some architects do everything, and they dive in and they say, here's five contractors you should use, and here's the contract you should use, and everything else. And I think that architects can add an excellent service by saying, these are the contractors that I think would be good for your project. I think that's a really good role they play. If I get a call from an owner and they say, hey, can you recommend contractors? I'm going to say, have you talked to your architect? Because that's not my field. My field isn't knowing whether good general contractors, although I know quite a few of them in the city and who's good and who's bad. My job is to make sure that the contract that's executed is in the best way possible. So the architect can assist in that, and they can say establishing a list of prospective contractors. That's a good service you can provide. And then you can assist the owner in obtaining competitive bids. They're going to be better at that. They're going to be better at reaching out to the contractor saying, here's my drawings and get this. I'm not going to analyze as your lawyer. I'm not going to analyze the pricing. So these are services the architect can provide. Are the bids responsive to proposal? Are they responsiveness of the bids and proposals, but successful in awarding and preparing the contract for construction? This 2, 3, and 4 is an area of my specialty. Not all construction lawyers do that. I specialize in the procurement process. I draft RFPs. I actually advise owners on how to do the bidding process. I don't say to them, here's your five contractors, but I say to them, whatever those five contractors are, here's the process you should go through to make sure you're picking the best one. It's a very technical process. I've done it on projects all the way up to $1 billion. I've done it projects all the way down to $1 million, where how you actually make the most and best informed decision on the procurement. Architects do this as too. And of course, I'm biased because it's a specialty of mine. I think architects are okay at it, even though they do it a lot. And not to say that I've seen some architects that do it very well, but my process that I do, because I specialize in it, is very protective of the owner and making sure that you do it right. But architects can do the services too. And I've also worked very much collaboratively with architects on this. This is called procurement. How do you go out and procure the right contractor to do the work? And what's the RFP look like? And how do you do the bids and estimates and rankings and all sort of stuff? So, and there's two different ways you can do it. Competitive bidding. Competitive bidding is basically what you... all government projects have to be competitive bidding, and they have to be the lowest responsible bid. Not just a low bid, it's the lowest, or, I'm sorry, I said it, let me say it again. Lowest responsible and responsive bid. So the lowest contractor doesn't always win in government projects. The bid has to be, the bid coming in has to be responsive and responsible, meaning it's responsive to all the information that's being asked for, and it's responsible meaning that they actually have the skill set to perform the work. But generally, government projects are the lowest bid, which is called competitive bidding. So that's one method that's talked about in the AIA that the architect can help them on. Okay. And as an additional service during this process, you can say, hey, we can look at substitutions and other stuff so we can make some more money off of this if you need. The second one is called, the second type of procurement and proposal is what's called a negotiated proposal. A negotiated proposal is I get five bids in and I don't necessarily pick the lowest bid. I pick the bid that I think may best fit me. It may be the second lowest or even the third lowest, but as I start to interview the teams and they do an RFP presentation to me and I start to hear what the team is and what they're going to do, I like them and I say, okay, I like party A and party C. We're going to eliminate B and D and E. We're going to leave those two and we're going to have like a horse race where we're going to negotiate against each other to try to ultimately get to the final one. That's what happens with a negotiated proposal. That happens mostly in the private sector. Competitive is largely government because you have to spend the least amount of the public's money. That's why it's always competitive. There are some exceptions for certain types of projects, but almost all public jobs are the lowest bid. Private sector, you don't have to follow those governmental rules, so you can spend the money you want, but you still want to get the best deal, So I always often recommend using a negotiated proposal. There's always going to be a couple of good contractors out there, so let's see if we can get the best deal from them. And I work with contractors, I work with owners on this, and architects can do that as well. So there's a movie from 100 years ago called Armageddon. I don't know if any of you guys have ever seen Armageddon. It was back in the, I'm trying to think when it would have been, probably in the mid-90s. It's got Ben Affleck and Bruce Willis, and they fly up because there's one of these giant comet killers coming to blow up the Earth. And their job is to fly these two souped-up space shuttles and land on the Owen Wilson's in it, and land on the asteroid, and they're supposed to drill and put a nuclear warhead in it, and it's going to explode and blow up the asteroid. And that's what it is. And as they're getting on the on the rocket, Steve Buscemi, who's kind of the crazy man in the movie, he's like, you know, and they're none of them, by the way, none of them are astronauts. They're wildcatters. They're people that drill oil fields. It's this kind of this wacky band of people that come in that NASA brings in, and I'm trying to remember the guy that's from NASA anyway. They bring in to fly them in to save the world. And so the Tyler's in it, everything else. So this guy, Steve Buscemi, he's like sitting as the rocket's about to take off. He's like, you know, here we are sitting on something going to space with the lowest bid contractor, and like nuts and bolts are falling off, and he's making this thing like, you know, we're leaving the safety of our lives in the hands of the lowest bid contract because all government projects are low bid. So whenever I get this lecture, I always think about that one scene in Armageddon. So I should actually drop that into this lecture. Maybe I should put that slide in next year. I didn't even think about it until just now. So. And then same thing, if you want to do additional services for substitution, you can add some more fees at the end of this. That is the end of phase four. Phase five, construction phase services. So if you want to think about in terms of my job as a lawyer representing architects, the two areas where lawsuits come out of, the two phases that lawsuits come out of is phase three, the construction document issue. The architect drew it incorrectly. Or phase five, construction phase services. While the project is being built, this phase does not start until construction begins. While construction is occurring, the architect may fail to see something, may approve something that shouldn't have been approved. And this is where the fights happen, mostly between architect and contractor, because the contractor says, hey, your drawings told me to do it this way, you didn't tell me when I was on the field I did it wrong, so it's your fault. And the architect saying, not my fault, you built it, I drew it right, and there's always this back and forth. So for legal reasons, for legal situations, phase three and phase five are where I get called the most. And for that reason also, some architects, especially small architects, don't do phase five. They say, I'll give you the drawings, but after that I'm out. So if something happens and goes wrong during construction, as long as my drawings are okay, it's not my fault. It's also an area you can make more money too. This is about 30% of your time, 25 to 30% of your time. So there's this big chunk of time in the construction document phase and a big chunk in this phase too. So when you're bidding your budget, and we'll have lectures on how to build your budget and pricing based on the phases, this is the second largest of your phases. Okay? So, what is the construction phase services? You're going to provide administration of the contract between the owner and the contractor, as set forth below in the AIA 8201. So this is the first time that we've seen a reference to the A201, which is the owner-contractor agreement. One of your jobs as the architect is to help administer the contract between the owner and the contractor. And we're going to talk about what that means to administer. It's not your job as the architect to build it. It's not your job as the architect to tell the contractor how to build it. But it is your job as the architect as it's being built. It's being built in accordance with the drawings you created. If a wall was supposed to go in this line here, and they built the wall correctly, but it was 2 feet over to the left, your administration says, tear that wall down and put it in the right spot. I'm not going to tell you how to tear it down. I'm not going to tell you how to rebuild it. But my drawing said it should have been in this line. That's administration of the drawings, as opposed to telling them how to do their work. That's one of your roles in the construction administration, is making sure the plan, the drawings, and the specifications are followed. Okay? So, oops, did I go the wrong way? There we go. 3.6, wait, did I? Yeah. 3.6.1.2. The architect shall advise and consult with the owner. So you've got to talk to the owner about this stuff. And you shall have the authority. There are certain times in this contract where you as the architect have the authority to do something without talking to the owner. This is one. Shall have the authority. The owner says, I allow you to do this, architect. You can act on my behalf. But only to the extent provided in the agreement. There's only two or three places where the architect can speak on the owner's behalf. And this language is repeated and mirrored in the contract, so the contractor... So, like, if I'm on the project site and the architect says, oh yeah, you can do X and Y and Z, if the architect did not have the authority, because this contract doesn't give them the authority, the owner can say, that's not my problem, that's your problem, architect. You didn't have the authority to act on my behalf in those areas. It's only in specific places where it says in this contract, okay? So I want you to think about this. We're going to get into concepts of agency and some other stuff in the semester, and there will be questions on this concept. Is the architect acting under the authority of the owner? When do they do that? So there's only, like I said, there's only two or three times. So you may see a fact pattern where the architect tells the contractor A, B, and C, and the question may make you think about or try to remember, oh, was the architect allowed to do that under the contract? So think about that. I just want to kind of preface this as a question that may be in the exam. This part here, this next sentence, is one of a huge important thing for you guys to remember as an architect for the rest of your career. The architect shall not have control over, charge of, or responsibility for the construction's means, methods, techniques, sequences, or procedures. We're going to stop there. What does that mean? What is the concept? Do you have any idea what the concept of means, methods, techniques, sequences, and procedures mean? Any idea? Question over there, yeah.
Like how it's built.
Exactly. You are not responsible for telling them how to swing a hammer, how to crank a torque wrench, how to put up a window, how to shim a door. You are not responsible as the architect on how to build something. Shall not have control over. If they build it wrong, not your fault. Now, why this is important is, don't start telling a contractor how to build something too. Like, sometimes an architect's like, oh, maybe you should do this. As soon as you start wading into the water, then this protection. Because this is like one of the biggest protections you're ever going to have. This is your Iron Man suit. This is your invulnerability. I'm not responsible for how you build it. If I drew it right and you built it wrong, not my problem. And they're going to say, well, you paid me for it. You approved it. Yeah, but it was still built by you, and I'm not responsible for means, methods, techniques, sequences, and procedures. Your job is that. So you want to be very cognizant of that the rest of your career. Don't tell a contractor how to do their job. You tell them where the wall is, but not how to build the wall. You tell them that they're late on the schedule, but not why the schedule was built wrong. And there's all this balance. Now, we're going to talk about some stuff about where things can go wrong on this and where you want to kind of dance around it. But let's talk about, so that's the first part, okay? Don't tell a contractor how to build something. They should know that. This language is mirrored in the construction contract. It says, hey, by the way, contractor, the architect is not responsible for any methods, techniques, sequences, or procedures either. So the contractor knows it as well. Second part, nor shall the architect be responsible for the contract, or for safety precautions and programs in connection with the work. Now, this is the one that always gets me a little bit, because I've been doing this for 30 years and I've been in many lawsuits with architects and contractors and everything else. This is the one that always causes me some trouble. So here's what I tell you. What happens when you go to a project site and you see an open and obvious space where someone could get injured? What do you do? Human nature says, oh my God, there's a wide open hole there and somebody could fall in. Human nature says, you better fix that hole because somebody's going to fall and get hurt. We all want to do that. You're walking the project site every week. And this contract says you're not responsible for it. So if someone falls in that hole, even if you saw it, and I know this is tragic and terrible to say, as cold as it is, let's say the person dies or they are seriously injured and they have, you know, a close head injury or something that's millions of dollars of hospital care. You're not responsible for it because this contract says you're not responsible for safety program precautions and programs. Not your job. Now, I've had lawsuits where the architect gets out because it specifically says, I'm not responsible for safety, and I know it's tragic that person was injured. I represented an architect in that very thing. There was a construction worker, a laborer, and he fell off a scaffold at about 30 feet of the merchandise mark when they were redoing some of the tuck pointing. And he got a close head injury, and the lawsuit was for about $37 million because of the medical and everything else, because they had he was basically not quite life support, but he was pretty bad. My client got out because they were not responsible for safety issues. It was not their fault that the scaffolding was done improperly, that the guy didn't have fall protection, some other stuff. That's all the contractor's responsibility. But what do you do? What do you do when you see it? I mean, let's say you did see it. You knew that they were acting unsafely. Should you ignore it because your contract gives you protection? As your lawyer, I tell you yes. Ignore it. Don't do anything about it, because it keeps you out of a lawsuit. That's your lawyer speaking. As a human being, and I've said this for the last 14 years, so it's not like anything's going on in my lectures that I haven't heard before. As a human being, pull the general contractor, project manager aside. Don't put it in writing. And say there's an open hole there. Go take a look at it. Talk to someone and say, there's an unsafe condition here. And you're like, wait a minute, Mike, you just told me that if I do something that starts to correct something that's safety, if I start wading into the waters, I'm exposed. Aren't I wading into the waters? And the answer is, of course you are. And then when the guy falls or the woman falls into the hole and breaks her arm or has a leg off or something like that, and there's a lawsuit, and you get named as the architect, and the contractor's of course named because they're the ones responsible for safety on the site. That project manager you told, you didn't put it in writing, you just told them. Do you think the project manager is going to testify, oh yeah, Mike told me about that? Because then he's admitting he knew. He's not going to talk about that conversation. Maybe he will to try to deflect them. But he'd say, because if you can spread the wealth or the fault around, oh, the architect knew, they even told me about it. And then the plaintiff's lawyer is going to say, wait, somebody told you about that open and obvious, Mr. General Contractor? Oh, yeah, I guess he did. And you didn't do anything about it? And my client fell and hurt themselves? So how you get around it is you tell them orally, and they hopefully go fix it, and then nobody gets hurt. And there's not a record of it. Now, the reason why I say you don't want to write it down is because I was in a lawsuit where I represented a client. They were doing a renovation of the Monadnock building. And it was an elevator shaft that was left open. There was a TV show, interesting, it was like a parallel. There was a TV show on the time called L.A. Law. In L.A. Law, they wanted to get rid of one of these legal TV shows that was a long, long time ago when this work was being performed. And they wanted to write a character off, so they had her fall down an elevator shaft. And she died. And that's when they got rid of her in that, because it was an open and obvious, they were doing some work in that building, and she fell back and died. And fell down and killed. This guy, unfortunately, he was an electrician. He didn't die. He shattered his leg. He couldn't walk later on. It was very bad. It was a $4 or $5 million lawsuit. And there was an open elevator shaft. It was right at the time when this episode came out. And I'm like, oh my God, it's so ironic. There was one note on one meeting minute from the architect. One sentence that said, elevator shaft was open without protection. One letter, one note that the architect wrote in one of the meeting minutes. He couldn't get out. So the $4 million, I don't know what we ended up paying, but the architect assumed safety responsibility about that one sentence. Had that architect gone to the project manager, probably the open and obvious would have gone away. They probably actually would have thought about it more, because it was literally one note in one line in a whole like 3 or 4 page meeting minutes. Somebody didn't probably pay attention to it. The architect wrote it down because they thought it was being safe in human nature. But we had to stay in a lawsuit. So the lawyer was not happy with it. And the person already was injured, so it was a shame. But like I said, as a person, if you're in a situation, you see something's unsafe, pull the project manager aside. Say, hey, Tommy, go take care of that, please. And then move on. So, that's just my public service part of this lecture. So, now, continuing on. The architect, nor shall they be responsible for the contractor's failure to perform the work in accordance with the requirements of the contract documents. So this basically says is, I'm walking the site, I'm not telling them how to build it, I'm not telling them how to do it, I'm not responsible. This further says, I'm not responsible for your failure to follow my drawings. That's your job. And then it goes further. So that's all protection of the owner, or the architect, all protection of the architect. And then it goes further, it says, the architect should not be responsible, I'm sorry, the architect should not be responsible for the architect's negligent acts or omissions. Oh, I'm sorry, shall be responsible. So if I'm negligent as the architect, I shall be responsible for my negligence. If my drawings are improper, I'm responsible for it. But I won't have control over charge of and shall not be responsible for acts or omissions of the contractor or any other persons or entities performing portions of the work. So what this says is even if my drawings are screwed up, I have to be responsible for that. But if the contractor screws up too, I'm not responsible for their screw-ups. Both parties are there at fault. So this last half of it says, yeah, if I screw up, I'm at fault. But if the contractor screws up, they're still at fault too. It's not all my fault. This is a sharing of the responsibilities. Okay? Any questions on that? Means and methods and safety, stay away. Be a human being, talk to someone. And everybody is responsible for what they're responsible for. That's kind of the breakdown of this provision. 3613, subject to 4.2, which is a little bit later, and provided 3665, blah, blah, blah. Construction phase services commence, so this phase of construction phase, the administration, on the award of the contract. So once the contractor signs on the dotted line, now you're in phase five as the architect. And it terminates when you issue the final certificate of payment, when the final payment is done. So that's your job is helping administrate the contract. It's from starting when the contract, construction contract signed, and when the last check is paid. So timing. Evaluations of the work. So when you're walking around the project site, you're looking at stuff during this construction administration. What are you looking for, and how do you do that? Well, 362 talks to that. 3621 says, you will visit the site at appropriate intervals to the stage of construction or as otherwise required in 423. 423 is a section that's going to say I'm going to visit once a week, twice a month, whatever it is. Kind of give some parameters. But if it doesn't have anything in 423, it's just appropriate to the stage of the project. You have to be there more at the beginning, more toward the end when finishes are. You have to kind of be flexible of how often you're on the site. A common project is once a week. But sometimes there's stuff that's going on that makes you be there 3 times a week. It just depends on what's going on. Appropriate to the stage of construction, that's how often you visit. And you become generally familiar with the progress and quality of the work. You're only there once a week. You can't see everything. You aren't an extraordinary architect. You just become generally familiar. There's going to be times where you're going to be on the project site on a Tuesday, and when you come back next Tuesday, all the drywall is up and you have no idea what's behind the walls because they were able to drywall in a week. Well, how are you going to know if the copper was put in right? How do you know if they did the finishes right? What do you know? You don't know everything that happened in that week. You need to become generally familiar, not like, oh, I know everything. Nobody has x-ray visions. And what you're going to do in general, you're going to work in general to see if it's being performed in a manner indicating that the work, when fully completed, not today, not the day you're there, but the work when it's fully completed will be in accordance with the contract documents. I designed this space, this building. I got drawings, I got plans, I got sections, I got elevations, I got window details, all this other stuff that makes up my construction document set. As I walk the project every week, I say, oh, that looks like it's right. It looks like when they finish, it's going to probably be in conformance with my drawings. But maybe the next week you're like, oh, no, you did something wrong. Rip it out, start it over, fix that. So as you work from week to week and month to month, as you look at the project, it's saying, are we getting there? Does it look like when we finally get to the end of the project, it's going to look like what I drew? Generally, that's what you're doing. And I keep saying generally because you don't have to know everything. You are not the contractor building it. You are not giving a guarantee or warranty. You're just being there once a week, maybe for an hour only. So, you are not required to make exhaustive or continuous on-site inspections. You are not required to be there at all times, every time the contractor swings a hammer. Now, there are some projects where the architect is there. The project architect is there every day. But that's a different type of animal than this contract. This is, like I said, it's going to be once a week, maybe once every 2 weeks, whatever the project requires. And then you're supposed to keep the owner reasonably informed about the progress and quality of the work. You're going to report known deviations, so if you knew them, known deviations, not like, oh, maybe, I'm not sure, it's known deviations in the work, known deviations from the most recent construction schedule. I know they're behind. I know they're behind. And defects and deficiencies observed in the work. I looked at that roof deck, and it was flat. It needed to be sloped. It wasn't draining properly. I knew that there was a deficiency in that work. The window was crooked. Whatever that might be the issue. So those are the things you are reasonably responsible to tell the owner about in the project. Okay? Question?
How is that different than staying out of issues from previous agreements.
Good question. How is telling them about deviations in the construction documents and everything different than keeping out of safety? So safety and how the project is run and what keeps it safe. Are they wearing fall protection? Are they wearing hard hats? Are they climbing up on ladders? What's going on to keep the project safe? That's not how the project is actually the deviations in the actual work. The means and methods is how they're swinging a hammer. But this deviation is the wall was supposed to be here, it was put here. The window's supposed to be straight up and down, it's crooked. You're not telling them how to put the window in or how to shim it or how it's supposed to be attached or what the flashing is supposed to be done. You've already put that in the drawings. You're supposed to say what I saw didn't match my drawings. Defects and deficiency observed in the work, that's against what you drew. So you're going to say, I drew it this way, it doesn't look that way. So these are more, what you want to think about, 1, 2, and 3 is more about an observation of how it looks, not how it was constructed. Does that help?
Yeah.
Now, most good architects will understand of how to properly shim a window. They're going to know how to put in a pan flashing. They're going to know how to do all these things about construction. And so it sometimes gets into this gray zone, this gray line about, I'm seeing something in the way it's being built is not proper in the industry. And so, do I point that out as a defect? And that's when you want to go back and you want to tell the owner. You're not telling the contractor how to do it. What you're going to say is, you know what? You have this window, you have this area where you have a 10-foot window opening, and then you're supposed to have a header across that. So you have all these big bay windows. And you have a header across that. And then there's another series of windows on top of that they're going to open and close. And you look and they have 1 2x4 as that header. It should be a steel beam or maybe a 2x12 or a double put together 2x12. It should be much more structurally supportive. You can say to the owner, hey, I'm concerned about what I see because I'm not sure if that's structurally sound. And then the owner should go back and talk to the contractor. You don't come to the contractor and say, tear out that 2x4, unless your drawing showed it differently. If your drawing showed a steel beam there, then you can tell them, you're not in compliance with my drawing because I show a steel beam, you put in a 2x4. But if you don't go to the contractor and say, this is how you should build this area, what you do is you say, hey, to the owner, I observed this, and I think that's a deficiency. And then the owner goes back to the contractor and talks to them about it. Okay? Any other questions on this part? Now, remember I talked about the only where it says the authority. Here's one. The architect has the authority. This is when I am speaking on behalf of the owner as the architect. To reject work that does not conform with the contract documents. When the wall is not in the right space and it's a foot out of line, I can tell the contractor, tear down that wall and move it. And I'm speaking on behalf of the owner. Now what happens if I'm wrong as the architect and the contractor tears down the wall and then goes to rebuild it, and the architect's like, oh, no, actually it was right in the right place. Now the contractor has to build it. They have to build it twice now. What happens there? Anybody? Who pays for that? Architect tells contractor to tear down the wall because it's the wrong spot. Contractor tears it down. Turns out the contractor had it in the right spot. Has to rebuild it. There's a cost to that. Who is responsible for paying for that cost? Owner, architect, or contractor? Who thinks owner? No one. Who thinks architect? And who thinks contractor? Okay. The owner has to pay for it because the architect has the authority. On this one alone, they are speaking on behalf of the owner. Now, the owner can go back and say to the architect, you need to pay me back because you screwed up. So maybe ultimately the money comes out of the architect. So you guys were not wrong. All right? But the owner, because the architect is speaking on the owner's behalf, has to pay the contractor for it. The contractor is going to submit what's called a change order. I've mentioned that a few times. They're going to say, hey, I need $5,000 because I had to rebuild that wall and I didn't have to. Your architect told me to do it. Now, if it was something different where the architect did have the authority, then the architect would have to pay directly. But in this instance, if the architect screwed up, then the owner has to now go back to the architect and say, pay me, but the owner first has to pay. Did you have a question?
Yeah. Could you claim that it doesn't conform to the contract
document? Yes, that's if it does not. I'm saying if the architect was wrong in this instance. My example, the architect was wrong, but you're correct. But in this case, if the work was not in conformance, if the wall was actually in the wrong place, and the architect can tell the contractor, yes, tear that down, and the contractor can say, you can't tell me what to do, you're not the owner. The contractor has to listen to the architect, because in that place, the architect has the authority to tell them what to do.
I just wonder why the owner has to pay
So that was what I was trying to say. I said, ultimately, you guys are correct. But as far as the contractor's concerned, the contractor doesn't have an agreement with the architect. So he can't say, architect, pay me. He goes to the owner and says, hey, I had to do this. Your architect told me what to do. And the owner can't say, oh, well, I didn't tell you. He's going to say, yes, you did, because the architect has your authority. They're speaking as your voice. So then the owner has to pay. And then as the owner, I would turn to the architect and say, pay me back. But it's who pays the contractor. So yeah, everybody was correct ultimately. Who ultimately has to pay for this? It's the architect. That's why I said you guys went wrong. But as to the original, who pays for the work, it's the owner at that point. So
then, what is the architect ultimately have to pay for it? Just like if we only have, like,
meaning, then the owner goes to the architect to pay for it?
Yeah.
Well, what you would say is you breached your standard of care. You didn't perform under the contract. So it's not even a goodwill. It said you had a standard of care to do your job properly. You told him to do something, and you were wrong. That's a breach of your standard of care. So that would be a contractual claim.
They didn't pay that.
Correct. Yeah. Yes, exactly. So if the architect just said, you're right, or if the architect said, I didn't screw up, Then the owner would say, yes, you did, and then the owner would have to sue the architect. So, they also shall have the authority to require inspections or testing of the work in accordance with the provisions. So, like, let's say, remember I said that example, like, you're there on Tuesday, and you come back the next Tuesday, and the bathroom's all drywalled up, or whatever the space is, and you're not sure what's behind it. If you're concerned that maybe the plumbing wasn't going in properly, you as the architect can say, tear down that drywall. I want to see if the copper was done correctly because I have concerns. So that would be an inspection. Or you want to make sure before we do digging that they've done soil testing. So there's certain testing that can be done, or maybe airflow on the furnace or whatever. So the architect has the authority to do some of those things. And the same scenario would be in place. If the architect says, tear down that drywall, and it turns out that the plumbing was done correctly, the contractor needs to get paid for that. The owner would have to pay a change order, and then the owner would have to chase the architect. But if it turns out that the drywall or the plumbing was done incorrectly, then the cost to tear down the drywall, fix the plumbing, and put the drywall back up is all on the contractor because the contractor screwed up. So, it goes on, however, neither this authority of the architect nor decision made in good faith to exercise or not exercise that authority shall give rise or duty or responsibility of the architect to the contractor. This is the part where it says architect doesn't have to pay the contractor. This is because they don't have an agreement. But just because I'm telling you what to do as the architect, if I'm telling contractor what to do as the architect, it doesn't create a relationship between the architect and the contractor because the architect is speaking on behalf of the owner. And that's what this is clarifying here. So the contractor, subcontractor, supplies, blah, blah, blah. So this provision clarifies the confusion that has happened over the years in the front part. You were all correct that ultimately the architect has to pay. But the architect doesn't have to pay the contractor. That's what this is saying. I have no relationship with you, contractor. You can't come after me, contractor. You go after the owner. And then the owner may come after me, and that's not great, but you can't come after me. That's what this is saying here. Okay? 3623. The architect shall interpret and decide matters concerning performance under and the requirements of the contract documents on written request of the owner and the contractor. What does that mean? Sometimes the drawings aren't clear. Sometimes the code isn't clear. Sometimes the owner thinks the architect screwed up. This is a situation where people aren't sure. And so the architect becomes the person that steps in the beginning and says, maybe I can help sort this out. But submit it to me in a written request. Owner says, hey, architect, can you go see and check to see if the contractor screwed this work up? The contractor says, hey, architect, can you tell me what these drawings say? It's a written request for information, and the architect is the first person in to try to make a decision there. 3624. Interpretations and decisions of the architect shall be consistent with the intent of and reasonably inferable from the contract documents and shall be in writing in the form of drawings. So when you get these questions and everything else, your interpretations or decisions shall be consistent with the drawings you provided. You can't say, oh, this drawing is entirely different. You need to give an answer consistent with that, and you need to give it in the form of actual writing or drawings so we can see what it's supposed to be. You need to be consistent in how you're applying these. And then the architect shall endeavor, not automatically shall endeavor, means do your best, to secure faithful performance by the owner and the contractor, not shall show partiality to either one, and shall not be reliable for results or decisions that are rendered in good faith. Meaning, if you're brought into this squabble between owner and contractor, hey, this is a change order, owner should pay. No, I shouldn't pay. It's not my problem, it's your problem. You know, there's sometimes that happens where the contractor says, the owner told me to do this. And the owner says, no, I didn't tell you to do it. It's inferred from the drawing. So it becomes this fight between owner and contractor. In this world here, the architect's trying to be the middle person, the interpreter. And you're just trying to make sure the parties get along. Endeavor to have faithful performance by both the owner and the contractor. If the contractor did extra work, owner, you should pay. Or if the contractor screwed up, and contractor, you should pay for your own problems. That's what the architect's trying to do here. This middleman, this kind of mediator of disputes. So that's one of your hats you wear. Architects wear many, many hats. And this one is kind of the neutral, the middle. So we don't have to call up Hanahan and go to law school, go to a court. And then under 3625, the architect shall render initial decisions on claims, claims being a capital C, and that's in Article 15, I know, of the AIA document. I'm trying to remember what claims are in this provision, but I know it's 15, the AIA. So you render initial decisions for claims between the parties. That's a whole different process. I don't know if we go through it specifically here, but we'll go through it a little bit more, I know, under the A201 contract, the initial decision maker. But it's this first, you're the first one in as the architect to help resolve disputes between the owner and the contractor. Okay? Certificates for payment. So we're still in this construction administration phase. So it's a lot of stuff you're doing. Here's another hat you're wearing. You, with the certificates of payment, every month the contractor needs to get paid for its work, so they submit their invoice. It's called a certificate of payment. Under this provision, it's the architect that's supposed to review that and say, are they entitled to the money? So they shall review and certify the amounts due the contractor. Hey, I worked and I'm billing $250,000 on your project this month. The architect looks at that invoice and says, yes, they're entitled to or not. When you review, it's to the best of your knowledge, information, and belief. Remember, though, that you're only there generally once a week, so you don't have to know everything. And when you say yes, they should be paid that $250,000, your representations are subject to an evaluation of the work for conformance with the contract documents on substantial completion and the results of subsequent tests and inspections, corrections or minus deviations, and specific qualifications expressed by the architect. So any representation you're going to make is qualified to these four items. When you're evaluating, is it going to be in conformance with what the drawings are going to say? Maybe there's subsequent tests to confirm that. So you may actually say this can be paid, this you can pay, we're 3 months into the project, you can pay this, but later down the road we may have to test to make sure. A lot of times like tests and inspections for this comes in, like, did the concrete set properly? You know, did they use the right mix for the concrete? Was there cracking and spalling later on? Some things that actually have to test. So you may pay for it and then later find out they didn't do it right, you can claw back some of that money. Corrections of minor defects before completion. Yeah, I approve payment, but if we find some minor stuff later on, you're going to have to fix that at the end. It's not, we all know that you got to fix stuff at the very end. So that's what this is saying, is when you're certifying, you're not 100% to say everything is 100% accurate. And here's the other kind of get out of jail free card for the architect. When you issue a certificate of payment, I mean, you are certifying as the architect, I certify that the work is, that they should be paid for this. The architect has not made an exhaustive or continuous on-site inspection to check the quality or quantity of work. You're not there every day. You're not looking at every single thing done. It's kind of an overview as you walk around. So you are protected because you're not making continuous and exhaustive. When you approve it, you are not reviewing the construction means, methods, states, meets, or sequences. You are not approving how they did the work. You are approving that the work looks like it was done, right? You have not reviewed copies received from the requisitions, meaning the bills received from the subcontractors and suppliers, other than if requested by the owner. So if you are just supposed to look at a high level, there's one thing called percent complete. And you say, oh, they're 30% done with the foundations, and you walk out and you say, oh, it looks like about 30%, so I'm going to give them 30% of their money owed. You don't have to look at the bills from the subcontractor. You don't have to look at all the detail. If it's just a percent complete, that's what you're looking at here. And the last one is you haven't ascertained how or for what purpose the contractor has used the money previously paid. That basically says is you're not calling up the subcontractors and say, hey, the owner paid the contractor $1 million last month. Did you get paid? You, as the architect, do not have to check to make sure that the contractor is paying its subs. So this provision, 3632, says, yes, I certified and said they should be paid. But again, it's subject to these clarifications of what I did not do in certifying payment. This comes up a lot in cases. A lot of times the owner's going to be like, or the contractor's going to be saying, you approved my payout. The owner can't sue me for crappy work because you approved it. You're the architect. Why would you pay me? Why would you approve to pay me if I need to get paid if I did crappy work? You're the one that tells me I did crappy work. And the architect's going to say, no. I didn't review your means, methods, techniques, and sequences. I just said it looked okay. I didn't say you built it right. That's your job. And I'm going to say all the way to the end of the day, I'm not responsible how to build it. You are. And even though you got paid, if it's not built right, you're responsible. It doesn't matter that I paid you. You have to build it correctly. That's kind of what this says. Okay? Submittal. Submittals is the architect. So what happens on a project when you have a submittal is the architect designs stuff, and as like the example I gave you was, this is more samples, but the design says, we need to use this type of brick. The contractor has to gather three or four or five different types of bricks and submit them to the architect to review and the owner to approve them. I submit you samples. I submit you shop drawings. There's different types of details that we submit to make sure that the what I'm going to build, contractor, what contractor is going to build, is what you want, architect. So that's the submittal process. It's a give and take between contractor and architect. And the architect here under this one says they have to review with reasonable promptness because you want to keep things moving along in the construction process. 3642, the architect shall review and approve or take other appropriate actions upon the contractor's submittals, such as shop drawings, product data, and samples, but only for the limited purpose of checking for conformance with the information given in the design concept. What's this mean? So, submittals and samples, they actually give you a physical thing. The other thing that's mentioned up here is called shop drawings. Does anybody know what a shop drawing is? Raise your hand if you know what a shop drawing is. So a couple of you, that's good. So for the other ones, a shop drawing is, if I give you a layout of, I'm going to have a steel beam and a series of columns that's going to support the structure. I'm going to draw the steel beams. I'm actually going to do the engineering and the math to make sure that the size of the beam that I'm going to specify that I think should be in there, I should as the architect, the structural engineer, should be able to make sure that the steel beam and the columns that I'm going to use will support the structure. As a structural engineer, you're supposed to do that on the design side. But how the bolt connections are supposed to be and how the layout is and some of the details and what the flange looks like, the I-beam and everything else, what that actually looks like, the detail of that, that's going to be what's called a shop drawing. That's going to be prepared by the fabricator of the steel and the erector of the steel. Those are contractor side things. What this says is, When the architect gets that shop drawing back of how it's actually going to be built, you're going to review it as the architect to make sure it looks correctly, but you don't, it's for the limited purpose of checking conformance with the information given in the design concept. You as the architect don't have to check the fabricator's math. You did your own job. You don't have to check somebody else's math. That's what I like. What I call this provision is you don't have to check the math provision. The shop drawing should look like what you designed and what the intent is, but you need to be able to rely on the people doing those shop drawings that they were done correctly. And in fact, you aren't approving them per se, you're just confirming that the shop drawings are in conformance. There was a big case out many years ago with the post office. There was a collapse in the post office in Chicago. And I think there were two people died. And there was one of the claims that had to do with the structural members of it, and was the architect responsible because the structural failures. And it was during construction that it happened. And the architect was able to get out because they were just reviewing and confirming the shop drawings. There was the subcontractor that was doing the work that actually did the wrong math that caused the failure. And the architect used this provision to get out because they were not responsible for checking the math of the shop drawings. Okay? It's not for the purpose of determining accuracy and completeness of other information, such as dimensions, qualities, installation, or performance of the equipment. That's the not checking the math responsibility part of it. Okay? You do your design, but if it's turned over to someone else, they have to own theirs. If the contract documents specifically require a contractor to provide professional design services, the architect shall specify the approximate performance, appropriate performance, and design criteria for such services they satisfy. What does this mean? This means there are certain things that the architect doesn't design the specifics, but they design what's called a performance spec. The areas you're going to see that in most construction are curtain walls, fire protection, shoring and bracing when you're digging a hole and will the land and the soil around it collapse in. Contractor has to get all that engineered. So if like you look around up here in the red, that's part of your fire protection system, okay? I don't know if this is a wet or dry system. I think it is, right? Yeah. I don't know if this is a wet or dry system. So a wet system is it's always filled with water. A dry system is it only comes and fills with water upon whatever. An architect will specify the fire type of fire protection system that's in there. Wet, dry, they're going to say what codes and what they have to follow, the codes in the city and everything else. But they never design the system. The fire protection company that is installing it will design the system, including what the electronic boards are, what the smoke detectors are going to look like, when it fires, how it fires, what its locations are, and everything else like that. That's where the architect provides the design criteria. The code says you need to do this, but the contractor provides the professional design services, so the contractor hires the fire protection company, the fire system company, and so that's on the contractor side. So you will find in some projects where design flips over, it's called delegated design, flips over to the contractor. And this is one of them. Like I said, shoring and bracing, if you're digging a hole, especially, I got calls from a woman, I didn't end up representing her, but over in Greektown, and she owned this bar, she and her husband owned this bar, and then above it was some apartments and everything else, and they were digging a hole for a restaurant right next door, and some of her walls started crumbling, and she was concerned about that. Well, the contractor's responsible for doing what's necessary to make sure that the neighboring property, the land, doesn't collapse, because, you know, if you have a solid piece of dirt, and there's a building here, and you dig a hole, well, then you're going to lose some structural support, and the building may collapse into that. One of my partners represented Latin School in a piece of litigation that went for years about problems with the hole that they didn't do shoring and bracing properly. So, and then the last part here, the architect shall be entitled to rely on and shall not be responsible for the adequacy and accuracy of the services provided by these other people. Once again, it's not my responsibility, it's your responsibility. Okay? They shall review and respond to requests for information about contract documents. If the contractor doesn't understand the drawings, they're going to submit what's called a request for information, or RFI. When you get that written information in, like I said in an earlier provision, you need to respond in writing or in drawings as to the answer to the question. This is just basically 3644 is an information passing, question and answer of passing back and forth. How do we keep the communications going between contractor and architect? And then the architect's response to such request will be made in writing and within time limits agreed upon. So you have to do it timely. Changes in the work. The architect can perform or can order minor changes in the work that are not consistent with the intent of, that are consistent with the intent of contract documents and do not involve an adjustment in contract sum or extension of time. So we've talked about change orders. Sometimes change orders may not change the time or the project or cost. Hey, you know what? This room is all painted white. Maybe I wanted it to be painted orange. Well, the paint's going to be the same cost. The time it's going to be due it. That's a minor change. The architect can just make that change. That's something that happens during construction administration. Project completion. How do we get to completion? You're going to construct inspections to complete the project. You're going to issue certificates of substantial completion. You forward that to the owner, and then you issue a final certificate of payment. So the architect's the one that says, they're the one responsible saying when the project is completed. They're the one that tells the owner and the contractor, yes, you finished the job. The inspection shall be conducted with the owner to check conformance with the work requirements. We can skip this. This is not a big deal. Oh, the last one here that sometimes happens, although most owners don't take them up on it, 3665. On the request of the owner and prior to the expiration of 1 year from the date of substantial completion, you call the architect to come back and walk the project site. That's because most of the time warranties provided by the contractor are for 1 year. So you want to just have the contractor come back, or the architect come back and walk through to make sure that the warranties are done properly. And that's the end of all the architect's services, basic services. We're going to get through, like I said, we have about 15 minutes. We're going to get through this additional services pretty quick. I'm going to walk through what they are, and then we'll be done for today. Okay, as I said, these are areas where you can make more money, or there are things more than basic services. There are two types. Supplemental services, think about it this way. We're going to talk about it here first, but supplementals are not included in the basic services. So remember, I'm finding architecture, which is design, plus structural, mechanical, and electrical. Okay, those are your basic services. Supplemental is landscaping, civil engineering, lead, all these other stuff that's not in these basic concepts of structural, mechanical, electrical, and architectural. Additional services, which we're going to get in a second, is I'm going to give you electrical services, but it's electrical plus. So it is a basic service, but it's more of that basic service. I'm doing structural, but it's especially structural. So there's additional services fall under the four categories of architectural, structural, mechanical, electrical, but they're in addition to what you normally would do. Supplemental, or totally different from the main four. Okay? That's 4.1. The description of the supplemental services identified in 4.1.1 is the architect's responsibility provided that below. And then 4.1.1 has this long laundry list of different types. And I think I have a slide on that. Let me see. Give me a second here. No, I don't. So what 4.1.1 does is it has this list of, like I said, civil, landscaping, lead services, programming, fast trackers. There's like 25 or 30 different items of these additional supplemental services. That's that shopping list that I talked to you about. And you'll see it in the contract of the actual list of them. So that's what will be provided here. So, and it's going to describe, on that list, there's a chart, and it's got one column that says architect's responsibility, another column that says owner's responsibility. So you have to check each one of those on the charts, and you have to just go through, I'm going to provide structural, I'm going to provide landscaping, or the contractor, or the owner's going to provide landscaping. I'm going to provide, architect's going to provide civil, or the owner's going to provide civil. So you just check the box on that. It's a big chart that's in the AAA document. Additional services. Additional services are provided in accordance with Section 4.2 and shall entitle the architect to compensation pursuant to 11.3. That's your payment section. But it's in addition to the basic services. So it's like, I was going to do electrical services for a 3-bedroom, 4-bath house, but now you want me to add an exterior garage. I have to do that electrical. That's additional electrical services. That's the difference between that and supplemental. Upon recognizing the need to perform additional services, so maybe you don't know until you're in the middle and say, hey, I have to do more electrical, or maybe there's some structural issues, you have to notify the owner. I told you the price for this, but now it turns out the code is requiring me to do that, so I have to increase my structural services, or I have to change my mechanical because of the ventilation system. So you have to tell the owner and explain the circumstances giving rise to that need. This is the reason why I have to perform something more. And then once you receive the owner's written authorization, you can't proceed until you get the written authorization. So you have to sit tight until the owner says, yes, proceed with that. And this is the list of why you can get these additional services, not supplemental, but why you get additional. You can tell the owner, you changed your program. You went from a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house to a 4-bedroom, 5-bath house. I have to do additional electrical services. So you changed the program. The codes changed. I had to change my electrical design because of the code, so I have to provide additional electrical services. When they started looking through the instruments of services, the applicable authority said, no, you have to change that. Or maybe there's something that the building permit that's contrary to what your drawings are. So I have to give additional services to make sure the drawings are conformant with the law. Maybe additional services because the owner didn't give you information timely. Oh, you wanted to add a bathroom? Okay, but we're already halfway through construction. Now I got to redesign the whole project. Those are additional design services, so it's more than the project, so I have to redesign because you didn't tell me in a timely fashion. Pairing digital models. Oh, you really want to now see a rendering of it. That's an additional service. It's a design service, but it's not considered part of the basics. It's additional services. Alternate bids or proposals. So this is a list of different types of additional services you have. Going to a public presentation. You have to present to a committee, the school, to make sure it's zoning. Attending dispute resolution. I've got an architect on my hearing right now that he has to testify under the contract and he gets paid for his time because it has to do with the project. Qualifications or entities providing bids for proposals, replacement work, assistance to the initial decision maker. So these are all part of your design services, but they allow you to get additional funds for that. You shouldn't have to do work for free, is basically what this says. Okay. To avoid delay in the construction phase, the architect shall provide the following additional services and notify the owner with reasonable promptness again. So we're now in the construction phase as opposed to previous ones made in the design phase. These are the construction phases. So again, I have to tell you that these are additional services. Maybe the contractor gave me something out of sequence, so it's going to have to cause me to review something more. That's an additional service. I get RFIs that are not proper. There's too many RFIs. The contractor's flooding me with all this information. This shouldn't happen. This contractor's incompetent. Whatever it might be, I have to now have additional services. There's lots of change orders on the project that there shouldn't be. Maybe it's you, owner, that's causing the changes. You decided to go from this three-bedroom, two-bath house to the four-bedroom, five-bath house. There's all these change orders from that. I should get paid for my additional design services. Seeing if there's extensive claims of the initial decision makers, evaluating substitution. So all this extra stuff that you didn't plan on being part of the project, you need to go back and talk to the owner about it. So this is all the additional services. What you want to kind of think in global instead of each one of these individuals. Globally, you want to think about is things happen on a project that change scope, price, budget, schedule. And that may affect your job as the architect. And that means you as the architect have to do more work than you thought you should. It's not special work like landscape. It's not special work like lead. It's I got to do more electrical, more mechanical, more architectural, more plumbing. If those things occur, you should be compensated for it if it's not your fault. All of those are additional services. Tell the owner reasonably and have a discussion about it. That's what this provision of additional services is talking about. Laying out how you communicate to them and what the reasons are to entitle you for additional funds. Okay? That's the basic takeaway I want you to from this section of this provision. Okay? 423. We did mention this earlier when we talked about how often you're on the project site. It said, as reasonably needed by the project or as stated in 423, and here it has a blank. Under point 2, it says how many times you visit the site. You know, this is once a week, once a month, twice a month, whatever this might be. Point 1 is review of the shop drawings. How many times do you have to review if they bring you 3 bricks you don't like any more of them? They're going to bring you 3 more bricks. If the contractor can't get it and they keep bringing bricks and bricks and bricks and bricks and you never get it right, how many do you have to review before you get paid for it? Most of the time this is going to be 2 reviews, sometimes 3. And after the second or third one, then you should be able to charge for additional services. Same with visits. If you're supposed to be there once a week and then the owner says, I want you there twice a week or 3 times a week, you're in excess of this, you can charge for additional services. Inspections to see if the work has been substantially complete. That's at the end of the project. Contractor comes, raises their hand, says, I'm finished. And you walk around the project site and said, you're not even close to finish. Okay, you're right, I'll go back and keep working. Then they come back again, I'm finished. Then you walk around again. Now you're still not finished. How many times do you have to do that before you get paid for it? A lot of times this is 2. So by the third time you have to go back and tell the contractor, no. Then you get to tell the owner, in my original $50,000 bid, it wasn't me walking every time the contractor says I'm finished. It's only twice. And after that, you have to pay any additional service, additional fees. And then the same if it's for final completion. For 2 and 3 and 4 here is substantial completion and final completion. So almost finished and completely finished is what you want to think about. Under here, it says, after construction services are provided for more than 60 days after substantial completion or the initial date of substantial completion in the agreement, the architect shall be compensated as additional services to the extent the architect incurs additional costs. So substantial completion is pretty much at the end of the project. And you walk around the project site and you say, yes, you got to do this, that, and the other thing to finish it up and do the punch list and get everything finished. After 60 days, if you're still there and still trying to get the project to finish and trying to get across the finish line, this one says, I get additional services. It's again, you should expect that once you're substantial completion, that the contractor should be able to get it across the finish line in the next 60 days. But if you're there for 3 months, 6 months, a year, I have a project right now, the architect was on doing additional walkthroughs and everything for 2.5 years for a project. Now, they never charged additional costs, but they could have. This one says after 60 days of substantial completion, you can ask for more funds. And then if the services have not, under the agreement, not completed by within X number of months, then the architect can increase their rates. A lot of times, like you may have a project where the architect thinks the whole project is going to last maybe 2 years or 18 months. And then the owner stalls the project or the contractor is delayed or whatever it is, and now it's gone from 2 years to 3 years. So the architect should be able to raise its rates. This is all these are about business and cost. Question?
What if the architect, like, or if the architect intentionally stall a project to make more money?
An architect could intentionally stall a project to make more money, but then they would be in negligent and derelict of their standard of care, and so then you would go back and you would say, you gave me a schedule, and what have you done that's not in deviance? I didn't change the schedule, I didn't force that, so you're responsible. Not only do I not have to pay you more, but my contractor that had to sit on the project site waiting for your drawings and you stalled it out for an extra 6 months, and the $300,000 I had to pay them for additional general conditions, now you have to not pay you more. You have to pay me because I had to pay him $300,000 more. So you don't want to intentionally stall just to get a few more bucks at the end. Question?
Give them 60 days of free work.
It's not free work. So the question is does 424 give the owner 60 days of free work? Well, that's not additional work. So what happens is when we get, and we haven't really talked about substantial completion, and I'm right at time, so let me just finish this. And this, by the way, is our last slide. But not that I won't answer any of the questions. I just don't want to keep you guys here too long because I'm already right at time. But substantial completion is a concept. Is when the building is fit for its intended use and purposes. If I'm designing a candy factory at substantial completion, I can start making candy. If I'm designing a school at substantial completion, the kids can go to school. If I'm designing a home at substantial completion, you can move in. It's not final completion, though. Because when I walk around that candy factory, that school, or the house, I'm going to say, you screwed up on some paint here. Or that cover plate for that electrical outlet's been cracked. Or I got some light fixtures that are not filled. Or I have, you know, there's some spackle and putty here. There's these little minor, kind of minor things that need to be fixed, finished up, and that's called punch lists. And the punch list from substantial completion gets you to final completion when the last check is written. And that final completion, normally in a normal project, what this contemplates is 60 days is about the amount of time from substantial completion to final completion to get the little tweaks and the bugs out. Parties can stay in a complex project like my Haribo factory between substantial completion and final completion. It was over a year. But it was a $350 million facility. And there was equipment and machinery and everything else. So there was a ton of stuff that had to happen. So bigger projects, you may extend that. So it's not additional services because the architect still has to get them to the finish line. When the contractor says, I'm substantially complete, architect walks around and says, fix this, fix that, cover plate here, light bulb there. And then the contractor calls them up and says, hey, I'm done. I'm really done. And the architect comes back and says, okay, you got that paint, but you missed that light bulb. You got to get that. And the punch list can be 20 items long, could be 1,000 items long. And you literally go back week by week on that weekly meeting and you check. And you're like, check, 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 and you knock them off the list. That's how punch list works. You punch them out. And that gets you to final completion. What this contract clause contemplates is that about an average to get from substantial to final, to get all those paint things and cover plates and lights done, it's about 60 days. And if it goes longer because the contractor's dragging their heels and not doing their job, architect's like, hey, I got to move on to my next project. I thought we were going to be done, so I got to get paid for it. I already gave you a bid for the $50,000, but now I'm lingering around for another month or two or three. I need some more money. So that 60 days isn't free. It's part of your original bid. But after that 60 days, you can get additional service. Okay? Any questions out of that? All right. We will see you guys. Have a good weekend. I always ask this, but I never get full participation. Any predictions on the Super Bowl? No. What? Chiefs?